All right, so Katrin is Swiss. She speaks, as you see in your program, five languages. Anyone going to top that, by the way, if you exclude computer languages? polyglot and founder of the International Business Circle. As I mentioned at the outset of today, one of the happy consequences, if unintended consequences, of this topic has been the number of international resources that have surfaced in the area, and I hope that one of the functions of this is able to introduce them. She's the founder of the International Business Circle. She is also an entrepreneur herself, as you'll see listening to the program, an apprepreneur, and is the co-creator of Peak Meetings, an iPhone app which regularly hits the number one spot on Apple's What's Hot list. She's going to speak for about 15 minutes. We'll hold questions until the end of the panel. We'll write into the panel discussion that Robert's going to moderate, and I'll allow Robert to introduce his co-panelists at that time. So help me welcome Katrin Windsor.
Bonjour, c'est un plaisir d'être ici avec vous. Guten Tag, es freut mich hier zu sein mit Ihnen. Buenos días, es con mucho gusto que estoy aquí con ustedes. And hello, it's a pleasure to be here with you today and to talk with you about identifying international opportunities. It's a big wide world out there. There's lots of opportunities, a lot of complexity, and also quite a bit of risk. And when we talk about identifying international opportunities, there's really kind of two aspects to it. One is you think there is an opportunity, you get something that tells you that there is an opportunity, and then the other one is, how do you know it's real? So, as we know, the world outside of the U.S. is different. In business and in culture, business is all about people. And just to set the context about differences in meaning, sensitivities, I found a pretty good picture here. Okay. Different sensitivities. Now, here, you would not see this in the US. It would not go down very well, right? But in Germany, this is for a job fair. This is really hip in Germany. They have different sensitivities. And what I'd like to point out is, like, also look at the writing. There are better ways to make career. It's English, but not really. It's wrong English. And you couldn't write this slogan sitting here in Boulder, right? Because you have to be German, and then you have to translate it into English and come up with a really cool English slogan for the Germans, right? So now, I didn't want to, you know, go below the belt line right away, so but I thought he makes a good point. Is anybody interested in understanding the meaning of this? Okay. So you know about brown nosing, okay? And so in Germany, it's not just brown nosing. If you want to be successful in a corporation and have a successful career, the stereotypical idea is that you have to brown nose so well that you actually creep, you know, have to go inside it. And so the meaning of this is that come, we help you find another job, so you don't have to keep going inside, okay? Now, you could not come up with this out of context. You would have to be in Germany, you know, in order to develop something like that. Talking about opportunities, whether it's domestic or international, the business is the constant quest for profitability, for increased profits. And roughly, you can, you know, categorize the opportunities into four key drivers. You either have to increase sales, we have to lower costs, or have to increase the profit margins by lowering taxes, and you're constantly competing with the best talent out there. So I thought that would be probably an easier way to look at identifying opportunities. Now, my personal expertise is I have lived in 5 countries, worked in 28 countries, and mostly for U.S. companies in high tech, helping them expand abroad. So my expertise here is in sales, accessing new markets, growing sales abroad. And so usually, you know, the growth opportunities for greater sales manifest in a handful of ways. You're either global from day one, and more that's just happening. My husband and I have this business app on the iPad. We're global from day one because the Apple App Store is global, right? Amazon, global. And so that's one. Two, you could be selling, let's say, enterprise software. You have a client in New York, and suddenly they call and they say, hey, we love your, you know, implementation here in New York, but we're global. We need you to be global, too. We need you to also support our London and Tokyo operations. So your clients help you go global. I've also been involved of where we're doing quite well in the U.S., and suddenly you get a call from a person saying, hi, I'm in London. I'm a specialist in your field. I would like to be your reseller or distributor, your value-added reseller. And that's one path also that I've been involved with a couple of times. Or you may have special knowledge about a market. I mean, just sitting here today, you go, I think we got to really look at Brazil, right? Or your competition. You see that your competition releases one PR release after another, you know, saying that they're doing really well somewhere else. And you just know we better go there too or have a look at it. So with costs, you may want to lower your development cost with, you know, developers in India, or you may want to develop your microchips in Taiwan or Seoul, or you may want to have your call center in the Philippines. And with regards to taxes, the U.S. has some of the world's highest corporate tax rates. 60 Minutes just ran a fantastic special on that. If you haven't seen it, it was just a couple of weeks ago. It's available online. Have a look at it. They did it really well. And so, you know, you can buy opening up in Switzerland or in Ireland. I mean, you can have a 20% tax savings. That means you have to sell 20% less or you have 20% more to invest in R&D. It's huge. And you need to do it because, well, depending on who you are, but because it is a global competitive game, right? And the others, the locals are doing it, so it is very important that your tax strategies are maximized. Or you need to find special talent. For example, if you have developed technology for stem cell research, you know, the talent pool is probably not inside the U.S. where it's been so limited. You may want to find that talent elsewhere. Switzerland is huge in pharmaceuticals. Brazil is huge in agriculture. China's huge in manufacturing. So depending on which industry you're in, your talent may not be in the U.S. for R&D, for example. So now different countries, you know, where to go is a question. And so different countries tout each country has different strengths and weaknesses. And so Switzerland, for example, just to give you an idea how countries sell themselves to you, and they all have websites. You know, so for example, Switzerland says that they tout their strategic location. They say, if you want to go to Europe, why go to London, which is the natural place people seem to enter Europe, And because they speak English there. But in Switzerland, you're in the middle, you know, of Europe, if that's the market you're going after. Or, you know, they tout their highly skilled workforce, flexible labor market. You can fire people just as easily in Switzerland as you can here. You cannot get rid of people in Paris. I've desperately tried to get rid of somebody who was the worst employee I ever had. And we finally figured out the strategy, and then 2 weeks before we were going to be able to do it, she announced she was pregnant, and so you had to pay like an 18-month maternity leave. So, you know, and then also the Switzerland, for example, touts the fantastic infrastructure. You can really whiz all over Europe in no time at all, high quality of life, which is important if you have to move your executives from here to there. You want to make sure that they're going to be able to put the kids in the right environment and that they're going to be happy. So I just use Switzerland because, of course, I am totally biased. But eBay, for example, has its international headquarters in Zurich, in Switzerland. HP has its international headquarters in Switzerland. Google has its international European headquarters in Ireland. Its R&D headquarters outside of Mountain View in Zurich. So this is a great... Who has seen this, by the way? You must... It's online. You must read it or at least scan it. It's fantastic. Because the World Economic Forum puts it out. They look at the countries, at 12 trades from different countries. They look at, is the institutional playing field level? You know, can you compete well? Is the infrastructure good? Can you move your goods around? Is the telecommunications infrastructure good? Macroeconomic environment, health and primary, all these things. Labor market efficiency, that's the horrible experience I just had in France. And so it market size, so for example here, Sweden is lower because it's a smaller market. So it looks at these, and ideally you have a beautiful, you know, round circle on the outside. And this are France, Germany, UK, Sweden. And as you can see, it's pretty high and pretty balanced round circle. Now, here is Southern Europe, Spain, Italy, or less developed, Spain, Italy, Poland, and the Czech Republic. And it's gives you just a very quick idea of, first of all, it's lower ranked, so maybe you don't want to set up headquarters there, but you can sell from another place into there. And then we have Brazil, which I spent a lot of time recently in Latin America. I think the last 2.5 years, I spent probably 60% of my time in the Latin countries. Brazil was huge in what I was doing. And when I saw this the other day, you know, the legal framework, I was not surprised. Because the way our Brazilian colleagues were doing contracts for us as, you know, Western European, me as a Western European American, we have, when we say contract, we think of one way of contract, but the Brazilians think of contract very differently. If we say, well, but that was the deal, here it spells it out in the contract, and for them it's more just kind of a guideline, and they're constantly changing it, and it was driving our CFO nuts, and it was driving our GC nuts. So we started relaxing, and just we just have to trust our Brazilian colleagues. But anyway, this report points out these things quite well. Interesting here is that it ranks these countries. And so the U.S. is fourth. You probably, as an American business, will feel most comfortable in dealing in the top 10, 15 countries because they are the most similar in terms of efficiency of doing business. You can get the money in, but also out, culturally, etc., innovation, highly educated workforce, etc. Now, down here, if you go here, you probably feel a little less comfortable. I just had a pretty bad experience in the Dominican Republic. We went to a hugely important, strategically important Pan-Hispanic annual conference, and there were three of us who were keynoting there in Santo Domingo. We arrived. I had thought of the Dominican Republic as a Cancun-like kind of beach, palm trees, beautiful, organized resorts, etc. Well, we were in the city of Santo Domingo. It was a one-week tropical rainstorm, non-stop tropical rainstorm. The garbage was floating down the street. You couldn't find any taxis. And the electricity went out every half hour. And the conference set up really strange things for us that we didn't even know what to do with. So it was horrendous. So infrastructure, right? Again, here they listed stage one developed countries, Bangladesh here, and then we have, you know, the U.S. is on the most developed countries. And again, you probably will feel most comfortable as in this area. You may use a Bangladesh for clothing manufacturing, very one-point solutions, very specialized, but you're probably not going to set up your Asian headquarters in Bangladesh. So you think you have an opportunity, but is it real? This is a mirage, Fata Morgana, and so it's time to start sending in the camel riders and go check it out if there's water, right? So we want to do some market research. We got to go there, got to spend a lot of time there. And ideally, in an ideal world, you take these beautiful diagrams, and you know, it's very linear, one box after another, and you get it done. In reality, that's more kind of what we're used to, right? You have the hypothesis, and this is kind of what I have been doing a lot of, is what's the fastest way to see if the opportunity is real. And so I've been mostly spending in enterprise software, so you develop a target profile of your customers, you try to line up really 10 representative of that, you go there, you demo your technology, you get feedback, you find out a lot of things just by how they react to your user interface, for example, and then very quickly, and do not skip this step, and I've seen it skip and it's been disastrous, you want to do very short pilots, you want to make sure that that stuff runs on the ground. And even though I spent 2.5 years recently with a SaaS software, so it was cloud-based, and we thought, well, we just translated into Brazilian Portuguese and Spanish, and you know, it's cloud-based, what's the big deal? The browser issues we had were significant. Okay, so you want to make sure it tests, works locally. Then you do one or two clients that are going to be very forgiving when the rubber hits the road in your first implementations, you know, and all the while, it is kind of like iterative. You look at what resources are we going to need to support these clients, etc. So lessons learned. It always, always takes more time, costs more money, and is more complex than you think. It is like a remodel, you know, so it's that's the same principle, only it is even much more complex, obviously. Don't just wing it. Have a separate plan for international. Don't just slap it onto your American business plan. I've been involved with that, and it was extremely frustrating. I was representing international for my last company, and I was constantly standing at the end of the line begging for development resources. Before me were all the big American clients, and here I was representing international, and I, you know, and they just like ignored us. Even though we were growing so much faster, the big American clients, you know, had the strongest voice. So always have a separate operational plan, have a separate budget, adjust frequently. Surprises and mistakes, English is not English. As we saw, a contract is not a contract, service is not service. When we say service here, we have very strong understanding. It's got to be good service. It has to be rapid, friendly, you know, all that stuff. Service, it's almost a cuss word in Brazil, they told me, you know. So business is all about people, relationships, and collaboration. Spend time abroad and master greetings and three sentences, at least three sentences in their language, even though they're going to speak English to you. And talk to the people in the trenches. And so that brings me back to the local resource. The International Business Circle is a by invitation group of international and internationally active executives. All of our members have extensive international business experience. And it's a tremendous pool of people who have that know-how. If any of you have international business experience, you can be my guest. Come and check it out. If you don't yet, talk to me, and I think with Brad, you know, maybe there's something that we can put together that's specifically for entrepreneurs, you know, maybe a global incubator or something like that, or tack it on or collaborate with others, but there's opportunities. And That's kind of what they say. So the local, you know, Stephanie Carter, she's a local international entrepreneur, Wallaroo Hats. She lives, you know, six blocks from here. And, you know, she says, that's what she says about us. So, and the last lesson, never underestimate the importance of local knowledge. Say football. Okay, so the ball is in your court.
I think we're done. You guys need any more on this topic?
So I'm going to cover a range of different topics, and I apologize, I missed the beginning of your session earlier. Show of hands, how many people are students? Cool. How many people have businesses in multiple countries? Excellent. We're going to cover three topics, and I just want to make sure the interest is right and get a sense of where we're going. We want to talk about growth, growing revenues. Does that sound interesting? Raise your hand, you can keep them up, so growing revenues is key. Cutting costs, don't put them down unless you're not interested in that, so cutting costs. And then the last one is specialized talent. So I think we've lost hands, but it seems like the first two are a higher priority than the last one, is that right? Or no, all three?
All three.
All three, good. All right, so with that, my name is Robert Rich. Brad was kind enough, I ride a skateboard around town, and I've started a company called Open Space, which is an app store looking to compete against almost everybody. But why don't we start down at the end and do some just general introductions of ourselves, and then we'll
Great.
Jump right in.
Okay. My name is Taryn Westberg. I'm a relatively new transplant to Colorado. I actually moved here from London, where I was living for the past 8 years last fall. And I currently have a startup called Glow, glowsite.com, which does paperless wedding invitations and online wedding planning. And in my pre-startup life, while I was living in the UK, I worked for a consulting company that helped companies basically kind of enter and grow in markets and improve their businesses based on kind of what their customers wanted and needed. But just by nature of the fact that I was based in the London office, I've worked kind of all around the globe in Asia and in Northern Africa and all over Europe and also in the U.S. So I'm happy to share that perspective today.
Jim?
Jim Franklin. Lived here in Boulder about 20 years. I've started and grown a number of companies, and I've had a lot of international experience, I guess, along the way. With one company, put an office in London, and one in Frankfurt, and then in a whole Asia channel strategy. And another company sold to Oracle, and then sort of ran a global business unit for them. So with Oracle, sort of the whole world is your backyard, I guess. You didn't talk about Budapest and Romania and all these globally low-cost centers where things end up. And then I'm recently on the CEO of SendGrid, a Techstars 09 company. We have about 30 people. And what's funny is we have like 16 in Boulder, and we've got sort of a handful in California, guy in Portland, Dallas, and then we start going to Romania, Uzbekistan, and Philippines, right? So even the first 30 people, sort of like international, from, they said from day one, just sort of, it's sort of by default, with a cloud SaaS company.
Cool. Katrina, do you want to add anything else to yours? Good intro for that?
Mm-hmm.
All right. So style-wise, we're going to be very conversational. If you want to jump into the conversation, just raise your hand, so I don't want to wait till the end if you've got a pressing topic. If I don't get to you right away, don't panic. And the idea here is I want to try to make this as practical as possible. And I think you did a great job of covering just some practical things, but I want to see if we can cover some real details. So let's start with growing revenue and maybe kind of start down at the end and start the conversation and talking about why grow revenues in different parts of the country. And let's talk about the positive things rather than negative things, and then we'll go from there.
So A, if you don't grow revenues, you don't have the company, so it's kind of important. But I think I'm coming from the perspective where when I was even, before I even had revenue, I had to think about where we were going to launch the company. And of course, you know, as Katrin said, you know, when you launch on the internet, immediately you're global. But you do have to make some really important choices in the beginning. So what language is the site going to be in? And if it's going to be in English, will it be in U.S. English? Will it be in British English? Will it have Australian kind of English, you know, twangs to it? So we have to think about all those things. And I think as a founder or an entrepreneur or as a CEO, you're constantly weighing this decision of, well, what is my dream? Where do I want to go? And what countries do I want to go into? And which countries or regions or areas are the most important in terms of my market and where growth can come from? but then also what can I actually get done on a daily basis.
So did you string match your entire site? I mean, did you go through all of those steps at the gate?
So I definitely kind of thought about it strategically. I think at the end of the day, you know, I went through all the analysis and, you know, all the charts and that kind of stuff in my head, but we decided that what we could manage was launching in English-speaking countries. So it was kind of a compromise of wanting to be everywhere and be relevant everywhere versus doing something that we could actually do on day one. And we made choices like, so for instance, all of the English-speaking countries, they're very used to U.S. currency. Right, versus if you tell an American you're going to have to pay for this in British pounds, they freak out and they're like, what does that mean? So, you know, that was a choice that we had to make from day one, that we were going to charge in dollars. We had to think about where we were going to host the company. Were we going to host in the UK or were we going to host in the US? And that has SEO implications, it has load time implications, those sorts of things. And then once we, you know, we started out as purely a software play, we do have kind of a physical product that we also supply. You know, we do paperless wedding invitations, so we also have to have paper invitations that go through to your handful of older relatives that can't go paperless. So when I was looking for a partner for that particular company, I had to be sure that I could find someone who could supply and send paper invitations around the globe, because my English-speaking customers come from around the globe. So all these considerations that you have to kind of take into your mind and decide where is the balance between all of the revenue that you have to go after, but you have to be realistic about what you can achieve to make sure that you don't kill yourself on day one.
Jim, you talked about Oracle and then...
So classically on the revenue side, what you'd mentioned, we had a package software product we were selling in the U.S., pretty successful at it, taught a lot of MBA programs, so people would learn it here and then go back to their home country. And so then we'd have people who would say, hey, I want to bring this to my country, you know, can I resell it for you, right? And then we also sold the Global 2000 company, so they were using it in Chicago and they want to use it in Frankfurt, right? So they're like, oh, could you localize this and can you support us there? So we started with resellers. We actually sold off like our UK rights at one point as a financing strategy for like 3 years to get some money up front. And then once that thing played out, we saw that was our pilot. It was like, wow, this guy was really successful, right? We sold it far too cheaply. But then we realized we're going to go put a flag there, right? And so probably not with a whole lot of analysis. Like I said, it was English. You can fly direct there from here. It's just it was easy, right? But it was very expensive. We ended up being part of Oracle. They're like, why are you processing your invoices in central London, right? It's like, that's the most expensive place on the planet to have someone doing your AP, right? We're like, you should do that over in someplace else. And but it was great for, you know, developing the market and having you know, feet on the street there. One thing we had to struggle with is, you know, where do you open an office? Because we actually had a GmbH in Germany and an LTD in London, and so we were operating in pounds and euros, and, you know, the VAT taxes and, you know, the web store is just... The complexity was unforeseen, and the cost. So while we had a lot of revenue growth, you know, there's a lot of expense growth to go along with it.
So
we were very selective then to use channel partners like in France. We didn't hire anyone in France. And then we went to Asia, we did all partners. As we said, well, maybe we'll put like a marketing office in Singapore, but we didn't want to you know, actually create entities and have that heavy footprint. We'd rather just use channel.
So before we come to you, I just have one question for the two of you. The obvious thing is there's more people, there's more companies, right? And both of you kind of use that as the classic answer. Are there other reasons, is there other things here in growing revenue and other things, other than just there's more people? I got a dumb stare, so I'm assuming the answer is no.
Reasons why you would go focus outside of one particular country?
Specifically in growing revenues,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Is there anything other than there's more people there?
Well, right? France, right?
Right?
The French like to buy from French people, so... You're having a guy in London who knows your stuff, your value props, can't crawl across the channel, right? Doesn't work. So we had to have a French partner,
yeah.
Right? And we'd have like a pre-sales engineer go over and, you know, kind of do that, right? So certainly our, you know, sales by country would go up when you have that level of focus and time zone support,
yeah.
Right? So
relationship being real important in localizing and that, okay?
Yeah.
I think,
okay, go ahead.
Sorry. For us as well, our product is more relevant in certain geographies than it is in others, so... Not, you know, it's not always the country that has the most number of people that's the largest country with the largest population. Sometimes it's your product is actually more relevant to the particular culture or to the particular way that they do something, which makes you more attractive in that geography.
Cool. Can you add anything to this kind of this conversation?
No.
No? All right. So that's it. If you want to reach more people, or you need to sell them in a way that's localized to their fashion?
What was interesting, like in France, or even Quebec, is they want a French version of the software because it's part of like the procurement process, right? It's like, do you have a French version? And we had to say yes, even if it was, you know, three revs old, because they didn't actually use it. Right, they would use the English, American English version, because that was their internal corporate language, right, for a large company. We found the same thing in Germany. They wanted a German version, but no one ever used it. We got no, you know, support tickets on it, right? It's like, it was just a checkbox. But then they would use the English version because it was a global company.
Any questions as we're going through here? Don't hesitate to raise your hand. So now what I want to, and we've already started to talk about this, but again, in the same thing, in this growing revenues, what are the gotchas, right? What are the issues? And some of those have come up already. Mm-hmm. You want to talk about some general gotchas as it relates to growing revenues, things you should watch out for? I mean, it sounds like a classic one is going in all English with all English software, and maybe even worse, you're from a New Yorker and you're really arrogant about how you go in there.
I think a big thing with doing business internationally is that everybody has a different sense of time. Americans are very used to it's fast, you fly in, you try to close the deal, and you come back. And that's just not how it works. I mean, we heard it earlier, how important relationships are. And so that's where people underestimate how much it costs. You got to fly there several times. You have to wine and dine. You wait until you get invited to their home. That's really important. It's almost, you know, like that book, Four Cups of Tea. You have to have four cups of tea before you're in. So it sounds the same as the Guanxi in China. And I think Americans just generally underestimate that just because you don't grow up with that sense of time.
It's more expensive, takes longer than you think. I think just in general, with like channel sales, you sell direct in the U.S., you figure out your sales model, the playbook. You're like, oh, we'll go, you know, teach other people how to do this, you know, adapt it for local culture, but still you think you're going to teach them. But it seemed like it was just a ongoing process that you've got to burn a lot of jet fuel and round trip and try to make it work. It's not as easy as it sounds like in a PowerPoint.
And what you were saying before, that when you actually put a local person on the street, revenues went up?
Yes.
Does that work universally?
Yeah, and they're there, and it's so important.
And we would hire locally. So like our London office, we might have 8 or 10 people, but we'd make sure one was from Colorado. So we kind of rotate, you know, one person here, like on a, you know, every, you know, 2 to 3 year basis through, but mostly hiring locally for those relationships, especially in Asia.
I think cultural context as well is really, really important. I mean, it's not just enough to kind of show up in the country, launch your website, translate your website, and then all of a sudden you're going to be doing business in, you know, in that country. I mean, there's a classic story that's told kind of in marketing circles about Electrolux, which is a Swedish company. They make vacuum cleaners, and they tried to launch in the U.S., and they had this beautiful, they basically just translated their advertising poster, and the direct translation basically came out as Electrolux sucks, right, which makes sense. In the context of a vacuum cleaner, but in the cultural context of America, it doesn't quite work so well. So I think that's a big thing. I mean, it's not just enough to, you know, translate your language, you know, into a different language, or even hire someone who works locally. You have to really think about, how does my product need to change? How does the whole look and feel of my brand need to change? I mean, in China, the color red has very kind of special significance. You can use it in certain ways and you can't use it in other ways. So it's not necessarily something that we would think about here in the U.S. Trying to go abroad.
So, go ahead.
And one thing that I also found, being a woman, there is also some sensitivities around, you mean, some things that are different for women abroad. And I got into a market, one of those rapid market development research things, and I was sent with the president of the company that we bought to do this global research trip. And I was 7 months pregnant, and one of the stops was Japan. And right away, when my Japanese colleagues saw me coming in, they're going, oh, this isn't going to work. You're a pregnant woman. You're expected to right away, as soon as you find out that you're pregnant, you're supposed to stay home. And they're not used to a, you know, 7 months, highly pregnant businesswoman. And so I said, I will give the presentation behind the podium so that I will not move. And so, And so I started out that way, and then I kind of got into it. And so I walked away from the podium, and it was amazing to see their eyes just drop, and that's where they stayed. And in a way, you could say it was kind of a wasted business trip, because it just, I completely lost them.
So are there other parts of the world, being a woman, where it was even different representations than that, other than kind of losing? Were there any cultural issues, any sexual type issues, anything else that's come up?
I'm going to say, I was in a Japanese bank once, you know, suit on, walking down the hall with our, you know, delegation, whatever, and there was a woman walking towards us who was in some kind of professional attire. As I walked past, she stood against the wall and bowed as I went by. And I thought, this doesn't happen at home. It just makes you feel uncomfortable, the lack of equality. Right. That is the default, really, I think, pretty much anywhere.
Yeah.
Hopefully not here, but...
So,
not my house.
And here's a good anecdote. So a friend of mine, a colleague of mine, had to go. We had to send him to Saudi Arabia to present this educational product. And he was very rare invited to go demo it at the women's college. And so, which, because they don't usually let men in. And so he gave this demo to these five female professors that you couldn't see anything. They were just black like this. And he said, we're so used to getting feedback, like I'm looking into your eyes and you give me feedback, right? And it was so weird to have no feedback whatsoever, right? Just these black statues.
So that was very strange. Somebody, we're getting feedback from somewhere. And maybe it's that microphone.
Also being title conscious as well, right? Is that make sure your people in the field inflate their titles, right? That's a helpful thing.
So we've got time, we've got local, we've got context, we've got potentially gender, age. Is that an issue as well? And it's probably different in different parts of the world.
Yeah, I think that I think that definitely kind of comes into it. Both the being a young female in certain countries, I think, is quite tough. My previous consulting company that I worked for, there were some projects that were in certain areas of the Middle East where the client actually requested, please don't send any women, because, you know, if you're doing customer interviews, things like that, people won't be willing to talk to you. It's very inappropriate, and they'll be very, very uncomfortable. And I think as well, kind of going into certain cultures, I did a project in, it works kind of in both ways. I did a project in Morocco where a good portion of kind of the government people that we were working with were very, 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 very young, but you could tell instantly that straight into the conversation, they were literally 3 days graduated from undergrad, from university. And so it was a very, you know, me being kind of younger at that stage, they were sending people that they thought I would be comfortable kind of talking to, but they weren't actually decision makers. So you can get into some of those frustrating situations.
Any last thoughts on growing revenues or any of these anecdotes or stories before we move into cutting costs? Anything? I'll take the silence to mean no. Any questions on growing revenue, things we haven't covered for you guys yet? Yeah?
In terms of identifying local partners to help with rollout, thoughts and experiences about finding effective local partners and developing that relationship?
Strong thoughts.
Strong thoughts.
Go ahead. You got it.
So let's see, Softbridge, local plug for local company, Bill Perry. I knew him here from a long time ago, and he has a consultancy, right, that helps take software companies from the front range to Europe. And so having someone that I knew and trusted here, knew our culture and stuff, and then he could set us with a partner that we could, kind of like a training wheels program, right? He kind of knew that this was our first time going there, and that was very helpful for sort of starting Europe. And then once we had trusted people there, actually, is Dan Eppel in the audience? There he is. So Dan is someone I know and trust, and so he came and worked for us for about a year, and he was going back and forth between Denver and London to try and help, you know, find management partners who sort of fit our culture. So that was hard. You had to have someone basically live there, right, and kind of split back and forth. The third thing was Asia. We found a partner in the U.S., a similar company, that had already gone there, and we had a very similar cultural fit, and so their partner channel, you know, was an easy adoption. And so we could kind of run right through Asia, and we're like, oh, great, this is perfect. And it was kind of a fries with that, right? You're selling the partner stuff and seller stuff. So we could do joint user conferences and whatnot. And it was a lot of fun and made it much easier.
Yeah.
Question. If I was going to another city in this country, another state, and I'm under a right member or association, it's industry specific.
I think that's a good idea.
Can you rephrase the question? I don't know if everybody heard it. Sorry.
If I'm understanding correctly, if you want to go into a country and there's these industry associations which are often thought leaders in their industry, whether connecting with them and asking them.
I haven't had the experience of doing that outside the country, but if I don't know anybody in New York and I don't have any friends that are from New York, I would typically look to industry associations and mm-hmm. try to establish initial relationships and kind of figure out the lay of the land, so to speak, prior to going in.
I've used that successfully, very successfully. If you go to the thought leading industry association in that country, and you connect at the top levels, and you kind of come in as over the innovative new American company or something. They also always want to, we bring in new innovative American companies. Kind of, they can be very helpful. I definitely. Plus, associations always need funding, so sponsorships. So.
Red checks, yeah.
then you support them. I think.
So instead of bribing the locals.
Yeah.
Sometimes you have to do that too.
Maybe both. In the back, we had a question.
That's part of your absolutely must-do homework.
Yeah, so we put an office in London. One of the interesting was there's all kinds of these sort of tactical issues. Was the transfer pricing, right? So we'd sell stuff to that subsidiary at what price, right? And as long as it's rational and systematic, you can't gerrymander it every year. But there are ways to try to do that, but it's complicated.
Yeah, I mean, definitely thinking about just corporate tax structure, but then also kind of local. Here in the U.S. we have state taxes, and then you have to kind of think about that as well in different countries in Europe or different areas in Asia. So it's a really big, it's definitely a big consideration. And the other thing as well, you brought up the point of kind of regulation. Like, for instance, in the UK, there's very, very strict kind of data regulation about collecting data, how you store it, where you store it. You have to register with the Data Protection Agency and pay them a lovely fee every year. So definitely all things that you have to be just very careful about, so you don't want to get in trouble anymore.
Any other questions on grow revenue? And we'll... Good.
I had a response to this as well. When you're thinking about kind of forming partnerships, the kind of more official agencies and groups are great, but also the informal networks, like Meetup is a great place to look for kind of other types of informal organizations who are meeting about your topic, particularly in kind of IT tech or the startup world. Open Coffee Club, which is very active here in Boulder. There's a very active London chapter. There's a very active Toronto chapter. There's chapters in different parts of Asia. So I would think, and also like your university networks or your graduate school network. So I think there's a variety of formal and informal networks that you can use for introduction.
That seems like it's just an extension of your social graph, right? Yeah. A lot of LinkedIn stuff, and it doesn't matter if it's New York or Toronto, right, or wherever you go. It's just getting that one degree of separation beyond someone you already trust.
Yeah. I like write checks. That still works, too.
Write checks.
So one thing that I've experienced that didn't go very well is sometimes I've seen that we've hired, and it wasn't my decision, we've hired, for example, the country manager for Japan was hired based on that he spoke good English. And he was horrible. I mean, his English was really good, but he was horrible. And now we've seen that people tend to, we naturally, feel attracted to people who are a lot like us. So if someone speaks like us, maybe has been educated in the U.S., we naturally kind of want to trust them more than somebody that has, language skills that are not as good. So resist that temptation. And also, what I've seen also is that companies we've been called by people, I want to represent you in my country. And you really want to have a profile of what you're looking for. Don't just take anybody just because they were the first to contact you. And also, you have to really manage those relationships. You cannot, give them 1 or 2 weeks of training, close the contract, and then go back after a year and ask, hey, where's all that revenue?
The key thing is you can't show up and treat them like a number. Yeah. That's probably the number one lesson that I hear from our foreign offices, right, or otherly located offices would be, you show up and you just want to know the number, right? So we would bend over backwards to make sure we did a lot of things other than
hey, how are results, right? You have to get around to that eventually, but that was a very sensitive issue.
All right.
Germany, we hired someone who said, oh, let me be your distributor, and they got our customer list for doing marketing, and then sold it to our competitor. So that turned out to be a bad situation.
I would bet trust is a big issue.
Big issue.
Yeah.
Right. That's why.
Katrina, do you want to start off on the best reasons for cutting costs and doing that internationally? What's the number one?
On cutting costs?
On cutting costs. Why would I do that?
Cutting costs. I mean, it's if I consult also on international, and right now I have 3 contractors, and one of them is in Indonesia. And so it's like she costs $22 an hour. She has an MBA from the University of Jakarta, costs $22 an hour, and works when I'm sleeping. You know, I mean, and she's good, and she's cheap, so.
So the number one reason for cutting costs is
it's cutting costs.
It's just cheaper. Are there other positives in this as well?
Yeah, and there's you know, good people all over the planet, right?
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
Think about who studies math and science, right? You know, it's not here, unfortunately, despite our best efforts. And so to try and find people that have heavy-duty computer science and advanced math degrees, you can bring them on an H-1B visa, depending on how that program's going, or work with them remotely. But that's a big problem. With Oracle, right, everything eventually moves to a globally low-cost center, right? So, the guy we had sitting in London who was processing, AR and AP, we did it because, we had an office there. That was our center of gravity. But, that'll happen in India. The expense reports are processed there. Our renewals team that was sitting in Denver, right, that we were paying, Denver wages to renew maintenance contracts. Now that happens in Romania, right, because they can do, a good enough job there. The European kickoff happens in Budapest because it's cheaper to do it there.
I think along with cutting costs, you can also, in a lot of instances, get more for your money. So my development team is in Indonesia, and I could only afford to have a U.S. developer for maybe 3 days a month, whereas there I get someone full-time, but I also get someone who's part of a 100-person organization. So if he doesn't know something, chances are there's someone sitting next to him that does know. So something I would have to pay, through the nose to have something like that in the U.S. And then the added benefit is my developer in Indonesia actually works with your guys in Uzbekistan, again, while I'm sleeping. And so I wake up, and they've sorted out all my problems, and I can go on with my day.
Also, customer support. So we have a cloud application that's got to be up and running all the time. And so most of our guys are in California who make it run, but we have these people in Romania that can now handle support tickets, at least the sort of tier one. So when the guys in the U.S. wake up, their inbox isn't full of, stuff, right? I've got to deal with this.
Yep.
And so, that's been good. Now, I think we'll do that again in Asia to move to 24/7 here over the summer to really try and keep a handle on, we'll write better software so there's fewer tickets. But
how do you find the people in Indonesia here?
So a lot of networking, asking recommendations of rec from recommendations of rec from recommendations. We probably started out with a long list of about 60 companies that we did a first kind of email conversation with, asking them to answer about 5 or 10 questions, and we shortened that down to about 10. And I did about an hour and a half long conversation with each one of those companies just to make sure that they understood our goals and they were a good fit. I would actually be able to work with them. So it was a long upfront process, but now I feel really confident that I have someone that I can work with on a really long-term basis.
And so the personal relationships from prior companies, and one thing we did was we had to work with someone we didn't know that well, was we sent them an easy problem, and we wanted to see if they could solve an easy problem easily.
Mm-hmm.
And then if they could do that, we're like, good, right?
Yeah.
It just gave us a level of comfort that they could recognize an easy problem. They're like, oh, just do that. We're like, good.
Yeah.
And then we could work, give them the hard stuff and feel comfortable with it.
We have a question here, and then we'll come to Jane. Yeah.
Could you talk about an instance where the drive to move something to a low-cost center bites you in the butt on the back end?
So we're gonna come to negatives in just a moment. I want to get positives out of the way first, then we'll jump on negatives.
Have any of the panelists had positive experiences from working with intergovernmental organizations or government organizations, trade associations, in the process that you use to get your companies up and running in these different locations around the world?
I'm going to say yes, but I don't know the details. So it's the UK, they're very active here in Colorado. Yeah, that group, yeah, was very helpful and helped us get started as well.
So you do that
with Austin?
Yeah.
No, I, I personally haven't, but I know that a lot of my members have used those, like the UK Trade Invest or Location Switzerland or the Indonesian Trade Invest. They are very, very motivated to give you great service very fast and give you all the information and introductions in their countries that you need, because they, you know, their quota is how many American companies can they sell to set up in their countries. So they are very good. I've also tried the American, American Foreign Trade Association or something, and I found them very slow. You know, they're U.S. government. Sorry.
We're number four, but Switzerland was number one in that tournament. And last year, too. Right?
They've got a different quota, though, right? It's how many items are in the queue rather than how many they actually move through.
I think we're going on a Zurich fact-finding trip, though. I think that would be a good idea.
Good idea. Good food.
All right, so let's move into the horror stories, because there are dozens and dozens of them.
So having low-cost renewal reps in Romania didn't work, right? They didn't sell anything, right? Because they're far away, they didn't care, right? The English wasn't as good as we'd hoped, right? So it was a lot of, you know, stubbing of toes. And, you know, when you have it right here, it was, you know, it was a focus area. And it's there, they're like, you know, the customer service level went, yes, yeah, service. You know, it's like, you know, it was horrible. But so eventually figured it out.
Service is a big one.
Yeah, I mean, I think... I haven't had that issue with my startup, but my previous company that I worked for, there's definitely an issue of disconnect that I think Jim touched on before. It's thing, you know, kind of the offices that were in Europe felt like the U.S. headquarters didn't care, and they don't even know when our holidays are, and they don't understand that today is a bank
holiday.
Right? Why are they calling me? Yeah, they don't understand at 5 o'clock I have to go get a pint. You know, they don't understand that. So, yeah, I think just having kind of cultural disconnect, but then also you know, in the U.S., just taking the time to put an effort into understanding the culture, understanding the way that those people work, and not just, you know, assume that they're lazy just because you call and they're not there at, you know, 8 p.m. at night. There might be something, you know, it's just that kind of thing, I think.
Just development in India is probably the classic example. Robert Welch is another guy here in Boulder who's got a company that focuses on, you know, consulting with people. I saw him give a presentation, like, top 10 mistakes of, you know, doing development in India. I'm like, yep. I mean, we had 2 of 10 correct. But it's hard. You got to, you know, have them come here and you go there and, you know, have the right kind of projects. And it's definitely, it's not easy.
At least what I'm hearing both of you kind of say is these people are either working for the company or they're kind of longer-term relationships, right?
Yeah.
How many people, that's kind of what they're looking for here in the way of cutting costs longer term? Or is it more shorter term kind of projects? Or a combination of both? So let's say shorter term projects, raise hands. Longer term, raise hands. So everybody's really looking for feet on the street. Cool. Any advice in that, in a sense? Focusing on what are the issues when you've got these people? We've got cultural ones, we've got timing ones.
When you have the people...
You've got a relationship like she does with an outsourced firm, where you, whether it's a dedicated person, right, or a dedicated team of people, or you actually have your own individual employees in those countries. Lessons learned in that when you've got, so we've got a couple of them so far. We've got time issues, we've got cultural issues, we've got respect
issues.
The
most painful one was American SaaS technology, and oh, let's just translate it into Spanish and Brazilian Portuguese and hope it works. And it it wasn't thought through. Like, there was no plan for anybody to do Q&A. It's like, hello, who's doing QA? Right? And so it's not being thought through, it's just an afterthought.
Well, that's the assumption that you QA the American software as well.
These are startups we're talking about.
So we sold an $8.7 million client in Mexico, you know, and the product didn't work right. And so it was really, really rough. A lot of people sleeping under their desks to, you know, try to make it work. And even with just a little bit of forethought, just a little bit more ahead planning, it could have been avoided. And it was very embarrassing. And, of course, the financials, they didn't want to pay. And
managing turnover, right? So if you're working with a group and... if someone kind of gets up to speed in what you're doing, then they're off, right? I think the loyalty factor seems to be very low when you go far away and on a contract basis, and that's more challenging than if you do it here.
What about managing language gaps, perceptions, realities, kind of asking for one thing?
You mean between like development and marketing?
I don't know how to get around that one. I'm not sure culturally that's the issue. Actually, I think culturally is the issue.
There's an ocean in there somewhere.
Now, even just going specifications to, you know, Trent, you've got a Russian developer, Indonesian developer, and we've got certain idioms, and does it extend the actual process of saying, I actually am in a waterfall method now? Does Agile not work? Does, you know, give me a sense of how that's played out. Maybe.
Very difficult. I mean, it's just hard to do it in American English and people in the same room, right? So then to have people in, you know, 12 and a half hours apart from each other, is both speaking some version of English, is very difficult. Probably in writing is better, right? So we have Korean partners, and in writing we were fine, right? But to try and speak to each other
was painful. I actually only communicate with my development team on Skype, like by typing. I've never heard their voices. I have no idea what they look like. But you know, it takes a little while to kind of get started. But I actually find myself starting to speak their version of English, because it's easier for me to adapt my language than it is for them to do things perfectly. So I think it takes a little bit more time up front. But it, you know, you can have so much benefit in the long run.
Okay. Do you want to add something?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
So
it's free reign. You can talk.
So
with
regards to language, there's the language, but there's also the cultural difference in the sense of, for example, we had a big client, a top business school in Brazil, was using our SaaS technology, and we were used to, you know, American feedback or kind of very direct feedback, like you guys suck, you know, or like it doesn't work, you know. You're kind of used to that, and then you work with it. But, well, especially in the Germanic countries, you're very direct. In the States, you always have to give a few compliments first before you then hit them. But in Brazil, they would always, everything was right. Everything was so polite. So our whole team would walk away from the implementation calls thinking, we're doing great, you know, And then we would hear from the local Brazilian partners that, oh, it's not going well at all. And we're like, what are we not getting? And so kind of how direct people are in communicating with you, I mean, that's where you need local knowledge. And then they would say, your client services representative from Denver, that wasn't me, but like, that was Deb, she's too aggressive. And I'm thinking, that is not aggressive. And then finally, after several calls, we figured out that aggressive, even how they meant aggressive, was not how we meant aggressive. I mean, it was just all this meanings and cultural sensitivities.
In Japan and Korea, same thing, right? To try and get feedback from your resellers, to try and say, hey, our goal is here and your actual is here. It's like, you know, what can we do? How do we make it better? You know, A, they're insulted because you're kind of shining a flashlight on poor performance, and then, you know, they will never tell you what you need to do something better. I mean, it's extremely hard to get them to get any of that, you know, useful feedback. I won't call it negative.
So what's the antidote?
I don't know. I think alcohol.
Right? So you were for them?
Yeah,
both. For everyone involved.
We hail, right? The other one is, like you said, like maybe it's not like you and me, you're not criticizing me, but you might say, you know, there's this other company, and I had a friend who, in their company, they had this problem, right? Or anytime they give a whiff of anything that's not absolutely perfect, you go, aha, this is them telling you there's a big problem, right? You know, your quality sucks, the price is too high, or whatever it is, right? And you try and pick up on the smallest little thing.
Cool. So we had a question in the back. Go ahead.
Yeah, just two other things that I've seen horror stories that we haven't mentioned yet. The first is not doing adequate due diligence when you go in, particularly on your partner. And I think the most public example of that recently was Nike ending up signing up a contract manufacturer in Vietnam that was using child labor. All of a sudden, it had a big problem on its hand, a huge PR disaster on its brand. The second thing that I've seen lead to problems quite regularly, horror stories, is a failure to put in adequate controls. And you need every control that you have domestically and then some, because you are dealing with different norms, different customs and such. And you know, it's not uncommon in some countries for the company to make personal loans to family members. Those don't always get repaid. And if you don't have the controls in place to go and inspect, see this as it's coming up, and stay on top of it, you'll find yourselves in horror stories with the cash just going out the door.
Any thoughts, comments? That's in like a statement and a question, per se?
Agreed.
Yeah, the due diligence. And again, I think just using that personal network and one degree of separation. We had a country manager who we said, okay, remit this money back to headquarters. Remitted maybe 10% of what we asked for. It's like, was our instructions not clear? He's like, no, I think I need to keep more here for this business. We're like, you don't get to make that decision, right? It's like, wire it, right? And so you have to fly out there and fire the guy. It's not an easy process.
Did I see? Yeah.
What retention strategies and tactics work best in which countries? Because I'm guessing that some might not work as well in others.
Well, I just know one retention strategy is just going there, showing up, visiting them frequently, more frequently than you would an American client.
How frequently?
I would say, you know, quarterly reviews would be good with important clients. Taking them out for dinner, you know.
So you're talking about employee retention, partner retention, or customer retention?
All
of the above.
So like, I'm looking at a software company going global. So software, developers, and then your field people, and then your partnerships.
I think, yeah, quarterly is a pacing we use, right? That there's this quarterly sort of cadence that, you know, I'd be there at least quarterly, and then, you know, once a year, we kind of fly them here, right? So that, you know, for the January 5th kickoff or whatever, something like that. And then one time we took a kind of our whole team there, which was a lot of fun too.
Hang on, we'll go over here.
But it's all the other retention stuff you normally do for employees, right? Just make sure that's happening. And I think there's a lot of other factors too. Like in Japan, like no one leaves, right? It's like once you start, retention's not the issue, right? It's the poor performer.
Right.
You're like, shoot, now what?
Question back, yeah.
Yeah, I just want to make a comment, like the horror stories and, you know, outside. I worked for Epson America for 5 years in 1997, localizing projects, product manager for Latin America. And we had a lot of problems like that. And what I find out is that a lot of people over there want to make money. They want to succeed. But sometimes they call over here in the United States and say, hey man, can you just put that sticker on that box in Portuguese? And sometimes America says, no, deal with what you have. So they're like, okay, great. How can I perform in my market if you're not listening to me? So I think what you pointed out, Kevin, the culture difference of communication, like you need to be able to like really say, hey man, this is what we expect, but how are you understanding this so that I can have my result? And the frequent visits, like she was talking about, is very important.
Cool. Yeah. Question over here.
Yeah, so I was going to make the same point. I've run several large international organizations. I've lived overseas, and you can't stress enough that the care and feeding of these overseas teams is of paramount importance. And unfortunately, in times like this, when money is tight, a lot of times travel budgets are cut. So people aren't traveling from corporate out to their field, or you're not having your regional meetings the way you were before. And things can fall apart very quickly. So for people who are looking at starting up companies or they need to set up operations, or at least have key partners overseas, that's not going to be something that you're going to be able to cut back on in mean times. That's just the cost of doing business internationally.
Oracle moved to online kickoffs. I wonder too in the long run. I think you can get away for it for a couple of years, but looking at the turnover in their field organization, you're going to lose that momentum.
And also, I mean, to manage your people well, you want to know what motivates them, what drives them. You want to know them as individuals. So if you take them for dinner, exactly.
Right. And in hiring also, like if you found you have to get it, you can't hire over the phone. You have to meet with somebody and look them in the eye across the table in order to be able to trust that person and have them before, right?
I think it depends what you're hiring for, right? I mean, if you're hiring someone who's going to be your long-term business partner, who's going to be the general manager of your company in a new country, then, yeah, that's really, really important. And kind of employees that work kind of in that office, and they have to feel, you know, you want them to feel motivated. And really, at the end of the day, you want to make sure that they know that you actually care, that this geography is important, and that, you know, you care about them as individuals and you care about them as people. If you're looking at more of maybe a contractor role, even if it's a long-term contractor role, then you know, it can be a little bit different. But yeah, point definitely taken.
I would also say it's cost prohibitive at a startup level. I mean,
yeah.
You just can't do it.
Yeah.
So two questions. We'll come here and then go to Brett.
On the startup question, I was wondering if you could comment on some of the distinction or the differences that you've experienced working with large cap companies versus entrepreneurial smaller companies if you're trying to go international, and what works in different contexts and things of that nature.
Sure. I think that's what really, with stage, which is related to size, is that I think when you're starting something, it's important to all be together. It's very challenging if you've got a development office in even North Carolina, like there's another company I'm working with, right? And that's challenging. And so we had like a dozen employees in the Springs, and made them all drive to Denver every day, 62 miles each way. They hated it, right? But just having everyone on one floor in an office building was still very hard. Because they'd come out of the office, they don't even have sales go one way and development go the other. And I asked one employee at the 30-day mark, I love to ask new employees, what's different about the company than you expected? And she goes, which company? Darn! I mean, she picked up on it right away. There's this company and there's that company, right? The left elevator people and the right elevator people, right? So to have people when you're trying to create something new and you're, say, under your third iteration, I think it's very hard to have just a geographically dispersed team. Where when you're on version 11, it's easy, right? You can package stuff off, you have systems and processes and all that kind of stuff, and you can just live on audio conferences. It all kind of works, well enough.
I would agree with that. My core team, when I first developed, like our very first launch, we were all in the UK together and kind of could get together and whiteboard and that sort of stuff. And it was once we moved to maintenance and incremental changes that I was kind of able to move operations offshore. I think the opposite challenge is that I've seen a lot of large companies who think, oh, well, no matter what we do, we've got the brand, we have the operations, we're going to be able to go in and we're going to throw a bunch of money at it and it's not going to be a problem. And they ignore the really important things, which is all the people issues. So I think you can be blessed or you can be cursed in that department.
Cool. You want to add anything?
Well, one thing, so I'm Swiss, and I work for American companies, let's say in Switzerland, and what typically American or American managers would do, and it's so dumb, was they would do kind of the right thing. They would come out and do the, semi-annual round of the office, and they would fly in, on Monday, and then they would meet everybody, and then they would fly home on Wednesday. Mm-hmm. And, that was nice of them, but I remember always when they left, we go, they have no clue of what's really going on. And so if you are ever managing an international team, or those of you who are, my recommendation is, go plant yourself in their offices. Work out of their office for a week or 10 days at a time. It's going to be amazing how much you can learn and how deeply you will bond. Go hiking and skiing with them,
And don't want a hamburger on Tuesday night. Like, in Switzerland, go have fondue, or something. Don't. I think that's another thing is, really try. Even if you end up not liking it, just try different aspects of the culture. Try different aspects of the food. Don't say, I want to go here on a Monday night. Ask them, where would you take kind of a local partner on a Monday night? And let them show you the kind of local culture and the local feel. And I think people really appreciate that.
And eating their food is very important.
Very
the
important.
Food is like
at least
a huge
try it.
Bonding
just try it
thing.
Once. Yeah.
Eat pig heart.
Yeah. Doesn't sound like it's any different than doing business here, actually.
Right.
Respect everybody. I like that. Any other questions? Yeah? Good. Specialized talent. You had great charts up there. Can we stereotype parts of the world for certain types of talent?
Well, for example, Switzerland.
I'm seeing a theme here.
luxury watches or pharmaceuticals or precision engineering, that would be that you find a huge pool there. Every country has their stem cell research. The Middle Easterns have very loose liberal laws and they have some really advanced stem cell research in the Middle East, much more advanced than in the States, right?
Can we go deeper than that in a sense? I mean, classically, if we talk about software, right, you think of Indian developers, a particular bucket you put them in. Mm-hmm. If you think of Russian developers, you put them in a particular bucket. If you think of Chinese developers, right, you can classify, you kind of go, the Indian developers in general fall into, they're very good at following instructions, but very hard if you need them to think out of a box. right?
Right, so there's a, yeah, so I think, especially with India, right, if you have, they're very process-driven, right, and so that's why you can't have turnover, right, and it's like the next person kind of go in and pick up with things, which is completely the opposite, I'm sure, of Boulder coders, right, the king of spaghetti code, right, and we'll have it done by Monday, and God help us if anyone else can read it or follow what we did, right, it's, so it's completely different from that perspective. I think, again, like the math and science, I don't know if I would peg that in a particular place, to kind of pick up people here and there, but, you know, India and China.
And are there others? Are there other disciplines? I mean, I'm such a software geek in a sense. Are there other disciplines that you would pick up, or other cultural areas that kind of make sense to go to different parts of the world?
Well, Seoul, like the plane from Seoul, is always full of chip designers flying to. I lived in Palo Alto before moving here, mm-hmm. and then I did Seoul, Palo Alto, and like that half the plane was full of chip designers. Obviously, they must be very good at that.
Cool. So other things, when we start thinking about specialized talent, so obviously there's cultural issues, there's specialized skills, there's math or science, there's do they speak our language? Are there other things from specialized skills as to what you're going to look for?
I think sometimes as well, particularly there are hard skills and then there are soft skills. And some of the soft skills, so particularly design. Design is very culturally relevant. So I had a really hard time finding a designer. I really wanted my first team to be all in the UK, but I had a really hard time finding a designer who could design a look and feel for our brand and our website that I knew would resonate with American customers, which was going to be more of kind of my target and my focus. So we went like 9 rounds with this guy just not getting it. So I finally had to look outside of that. So I think particularly things that are the softer side, if you're working with color, or you're working with things that are really hard to describe with language and nuances, you want to find someone who understands the culture that you're going to be speaking to. So I had some issues there.
Cool. Time-wise, I want to be respectful. We're getting a little bit later here. You kind of ending summary thoughts. Should we start over here and then kind of work through, and then I can kind of summarize the end?
I love international business, and I think you all probably are here because you love international business. It's so multi-sensory. Mm-hmm. It stimulates your brains because it's different. You eat the food is different, the air is different, the traffic jams. I mean, it's fascinating. I love it.
Traffic jams. it's probably probably the funnest thing about business in the last 20 years. It's just that growth, right? It really has changed me as a person. It's made me, I'll say, less patriotic, right? I don't think of myself so much as a U.S. citizen. There's this community of people who live on planes and go all over the place. You become much more like a global citizen, right? It's like not rooting for your home team so much, right? I used to live in Pittsburgh, right? And it's like Steelers all the time. But when you move away from there, come to Denver, it's like Broncos all the time, right? You get a little detached, right? And some of them think that's healthy, right? But not too much.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, and I just think kind of ideas are global these days. And so I think the more you can travel and the more you can get on the plane and the more you can experience different cultures, you'll have better ideas and you'll learn new ways to do things that will be just beneficial to your business. So, I mean, the best thing that you can do is go live abroad for numerous years. But in absence of that, just travel as much as possible.
Cool. Hopefully you got some practical advice out of this and some interesting feedback. I learned some stuff. Thank you very much.
I'd like to call the third panel up to the front. We'll roll into the third panel.
Bounce off my head because it could reflect now. I think he's good.
Oh, he can fix that?
I got it, but...
Carrie? Heather? We'll get going here if you want.
It's great to meet you.
Yeah,
we've been a customer for at least a year. So when we first started, yes. Yeah. Joe and I are like on Skype daily, so...
It's how long they trade with...
Okay, while we're doing the transition, I'm going to introduce Ram, and I made a fatal error in not asking Ram for the pronunciation of his last name before in the introduction. Whereas,
he also has friends in
So if I could ask the folks up front, we're going to switch out and we'll get started. All right, so I've got the pronunciation instructions, and I think I'm still probably going to mangle it. Ram Vasudevan, perfect, he's generously sane, is the CEO of Quizlex. And prior to joining the company, he had over 8 years of corporate and M&A experience with Skadden Arps and Sidley Austin in New York. So he was a big firm attorney in the United States before opening this. And I think it's going to be a really interesting discussion, especially against the backdrop of the last panel, insofar as we have the perspective of Ram, who specializes in offshoring services in the legal realm. And in fact, we have one of Ram's clients, Bill, who will be talking about that shortly. And then additionally, Heather, who I'm going to introduce momentarily, has a company which helps as an intermediary of sorts for offshoring of software products projects. So we've got the perspective of providers in the room, and we'll be drilling down on that shortly. So I'm going to turn it over to Ram. He's going to speak for about 15 minutes, then we'll get into the panel discussion to follow. I'll introduce the panelists momentarily. Please help me welcome Ram.
Well, Brad, thank you very much for having me. And for me, it's been this day has been very exciting, and actually it was going back several years as I heard the panelists and the speakers present. In fact, when we started off, Brad used the term brain drain and brain circulation, though for some reason brain recycling seems to stick to my mind. I don't know why, but in some respects, as I think about that, I look back on my life, at least what I've, in terms of my schooling and my work, et cetera, it's probably a perfect example, because I did my initial schooling and law in India, and then I came to the U.S., I did my MBA and my master's in law, and then I worked for two major U.S. law firms for several years, and then I set up a company with headquarters in the U.S. and operations in India, where we have three development facilities review facilities in India, and in one way that we're setting up in the U.S. So it is increasingly a cross-border, a global citizen, or a global world, as we are, though that's an oxymoron, as we think about it. But I think the true test for that is, at least what I'm seeing is, the more you do this, the more countries that love you, you'll find that more of them will want to tax you, and that's really the key test. If you find that there are enough countries that are willing to and eager to tax your income, no matter where they come from, then truly I think you've passed the test of being a global citizen. But what I wanted to cover today is essentially how to find and work with offshore providers, and this is very common. Whether, at least what we're going to speak about applies, whether it's in the development space or more so in the service space, which is where my company provides services in. So perhaps before that, just a 30-second snippet or so about what we do so that it'll help put it in the right context. We started about 7 years ago with three lawyers in India. Today we are a little over 400 lawyers, and we work primarily with major law firms and with corporations. Most of them U.S. corporations, but several European and Asian corporations as well. And essentially, we work with the legal departments and the lawyers in supporting their day-to-day contracting needs, procurement needs, and of course, litigation document review and increasing litigations and investigations, which we are seeing worldwide. So that's the gist of our focus is essentially in the service area. But you'll find that several of the principles that I talk about here will relate to in terms of most of the areas. So the first question is, to outsource or not, or when do you consider that? And I think that's a good question if you think about it, because obviously for the more established companies, say if you're looking at an IBM or a Dell, it is established, it's fairly, the process is very well settled. There are a lot of people who know what they're doing, at least in this, there are armies of people available in different countries, so you can bridge several of the gaps or perceived gaps. But what if you're a startup or if you're a smaller company? Does it make sense? I actually think that it's not the size in terms of the revenue of the company or what you look in terms of that matters, but what truly matters is what is the reason that motivates a company to look at outsourcing or offshoring. So I think the answer of when not to outsource is very clear in my mind. If cost is the only consideration, or you're finding the biggest advantage is cost, then I don't think it's worth doing that, no matter what. Because invariably, as you go into that, you will find that the various problems that were actually highlighted in the previous session and in the sessions before that, you'll find that you run into most of them fairly on a regular basis. But if cost is one of the advantages, and it has to be an advantage, if cost is not an advantage, then you're looking at a different value proposition altogether. But if cost is one of the advantages, and you have other advantages, then I think it makes complete sense to sort of consider that. So usually when you look at it, especially if you look at areas such as India or China or parts of Europe, etc., many of these would probably apply. Process efficiencies, you know, in terms of allowing you to focus on your core competencies, etc. For example, in process efficiencies, just one by way of example, though we specialize so more so in the legal space, how we apply it, we have several process experts, Six Sigma experts, who sort of work with law firms here in document review and apply those strategies in streamlining and making document review more efficient. So in some respects, it's applying skill sets from a different parallel industry, but in an industry which might not be readily available in terms of if you look at a traditional source. Some of the other, I think, advantages of what you get in doing that are obviously increased quality. And it's actually an interesting thing to look at, because the natural way to think of is when you do that, your quality is bound to go down. And I think that's probably right. And in terms of how you do that, in terms of setting the expectations, the training, the benchmarking, etc., all those are critical. But if it's done correctly, you will find that generally the value proposition will have increased quality as one of the areas. And of course, the other areas which we touched upon earlier today as well is access to skilled personnel. I mean, that's whether it's in the computer development area or in the biotechnology or, for that matter, in terms of trained legal experts, etc. I mean, it's an area, depending on which jurisdiction, there's probably a number of advantages in terms of looking to go to a specialist in terms of doing that. The risks of outsourcing, again, in terms of doing that, I would say the advantage is probably sort of almost mirror the risk, because we saw that the same advantage as the say quality is a risk as well. Because when you go into it, the risk certainly is how the two fundamental risks, I've seen this with almost all clients, is that what is the, you know, how do I know that what I'm going to get in this is of the same quality that I get elsewhere, particularly here? And secondly, assuming I do that, how do I know that what I'm doing is confidential and secure in terms of information? So I think those are the fundamental risk factors, and those are very credible and legitimate risk factors. So I think it is important to get comfortable in terms of how you would bridge the gap or how you would address those two issues. Because with the proper metrics and the proper protocols, it is possible to bridge the gap. And several of the reputed companies that do this in any field, again, will invariably have measures to address, say, quality concerns of clients, as well as confidentiality and security. There are global standards. For example, you have what is called as an ISO 27001. That's about approximately 140 internationally accepted controls on security, both data, physical, logical, etc. So generally, if a company applies them in India or in Japan or in China and US, usually the restrictions are more or less similar, and you can be assured that it's the same quality in terms of same standard of protection that is available, same with respect to other standards, as the SAS 70 certifications, etc. So these are some general certifications that would help address the risks or perceived risks of outsourcing. Some of the others, I think, are more business-driven. For example, loss of know-how, say, cost blow-ups or business interruption, say, in case there's a disaster that happens, how do you address it, etc. And again, I think all these are legitimate concerns, legitimate issues, but certainly can be addressed with preparation and with diligence in terms of reputed or established companies or people who approach the aspect in the right way, I should say, usually have, you know, DR sites to address, disaster recovery sites to address the potential of business interruption, or for that matter, in terms of clear budgets and frequent benchmarking to make sure there are no significant cost blowouts, etc. Again, many of these are sort of addressable concerns. So one of the things I wanted to address before we go into the discussion, panel discussion, is again, what are some of the best practices? Like, if you're doing it, you decided that there is a need to do that, what are some of the best practices? And again, the list is endless here. It can go on because it's very contextual. It depends on what exactly we are seeking to achieve. But you'll find that most of these apply in both in any context that you look at, right? The first and fundamental in my view is the clear understanding of end objectives. It needs to be crystal clear as to what is it that we are seeking to achieve. And usually, if we are clear on that as a client, and you can get a vendor to sort of make sure that the vendor understands the same objectives, then you will be able to align incentives and make sure that your goals match with the goals of the vendor and that you both achieve the same ends in terms of that. Usually the biggest blow-ups or the biggest problems that come up are when the incentives are not well aligned. So, for example, if you have an hourly system of tracking performance, but you have a product-based system of tracking your internal performance, meaning in terms of products that you're selling or products that are being manufactured, there's a non-alignment in terms of the incentives there. So, in some respects, many of these can be ironed out by having clear objectives and metrics to make sure that the incentives are well aligned. So some of the things that helps in this are establishing clear milestones in terms of having service levels, particularly in the service industry and in the manufacturing area. This can obviously translate into other measurable output measurements, but even in the service industry, things like TAT, you know, turnaround time commitments, quality levels, those are things that are very clear where you can break it down to and have it as a benchmark. In some respects, it actually allows several of our clients to get a better consistent work product, I should say, than using vendors anywhere else in the world. The reason is there is an application of a process and a science in terms of how the approach should be for this. So the other big area here is obviously diligence in selecting a vendor. So there are several ways in doing this, and one of the questions that came up was, how would I go about doing it? How would I know how to find an outsource or an offshore provider? And I think there's no one answer to that, but I think one of the easiest ways to do that is to look at industry rankings in the specific industry, perhaps issue an RFP, request for proposal to companies that specialize in that, and then just Googling the company to find out, you know, if there's any, what customer feedback has been, and most importantly, to get references when you go down to that stage so that you can actually speak to other clients who have gone through the process to make sure that, you know, what you see is what you get and what is perceived is actually what is it in reality as well. Some of the other aspects that the previous panel touched on, like having site visits, visiting a vendor, those sort of things I think are very critical, because in some respects, seeing it in isolation or in theory or a website or a telephone call, while it may help in the short term, to build a consistent long-term relationship with a vendor, I mean, it needs to be a partnership with a vendor. You, as a client, where at least we get the best results is where the clients make an investment in coming and getting to know our teams, getting to know our company, so that there's like a mix of culture and mix of knowledge and cross-pollination of the resources and the knowledge between the two teams. The pricing, et cetera, are, you know, things that really depend on what is the model that needs to be used. So particularly in the service industry, it can be on an hourly, it could be on what is called as an FTE or dedicated or full-time equivalent. But in product areas, there are obviously different models in terms of how you would engage. And to continue on with this, again, several of these can be covered by contracts, but to have clear issue resolution mechanisms where if there is an issue, and I can guarantee this, that in no matter what the relationship will be, just as how there would be if we have a business relationship, there certainly will be issues, and the issues will be compounded by perhaps cultural differences, language differences, timing differences, time zone differences, and expectation differences. So issues are bound to come up. So I think to have mechanisms that are usually set clear in contracts where if there's an issue, what is the escalation protocol, how, at what level do you escalate it to senior level, and how would you approach in terms of resolving such issues, usually go a long way in making sure there's a smooth relationship. Because I think it's irrespective of which industry or, again, which service level, which area the support is in, issues are bound to come up as you go into more and more, especially further up into the value chain for the client. And several of these, again, how to address this is to have frequent checkpoints in terms of to make sure there are no surprises. So in several instances, to have perhaps quarterly meetings, even telephonic meetings, and then at least have one annual visit in terms of doing this. Now, in to justify this, usually there needs to be some volume in terms of doing that. So in other words, if it is a one-off project, then usually it's very difficult to do if it's a startup of a relationship, because the investment that would need to go in order to make it successful would usually not be worth the return that you would get in terms of doing that. But if it is a long time, meaning a series of one-off projects that as a client you expect to have, or it's part of a strategy of developing something, say, having increased efficiency or lower costs, et cetera, as part of an ongoing strategy, then I certainly think it's worthwhile making the investment to see how exactly it would work, and these things will sort of pay off in the long term. I'm conscious of the time. So I think I covered most of what I wanted to do. The last one is really the jurisdiction and choice of law, more so wearing my legal hat on that. I think that's a pretty important issue because in some respects we talked about, for example, I think there was a reference to China, and that is true in with respect to protection of intellectual property. And in some respects, I guess, India is probably in a different level there because there is a firm rule of law in terms of the process, etc., judicial process, due process of law. But I think having clear, a clear guideline on what would be the jurisdiction for issues to be governed, what would be the choice of law if there's an issue, like say there's a breach of confidentiality or theft of intellectual property, how would you go about resolving that, getting those things clarified upfront and getting it contractually in a document that is legally binding both in the US and in the country that you choose to do is very important, because all these things, obviously none of this ever becomes an issue until something goes wrong. But when something goes wrong, the last thing that anyone would want to do is try to say, oh, did I sign up to this? Like, I don't know what the law choice of law is here. So I think that is something that is usually overlooked, but perhaps one of the most important things in making sure that should something go unexpectedly, that at least there is a strong redressal mechanism there. So, and we will address questions as part of the panel. Thank you very much again for giving me the talk.
So, specific to ROM, growing a company from 7 to 400 is pretty impressive, but after hearing that, you may have missed your calling. You should have been a litigator. You would have been a killer. All right, so I want to introduce Bill, Carrie, and Heather. And from my right to left to Ram's left is Bill Moos, who's a senior director and associate general counsel at VMware. His team provides legal support for VMware's cloud channels and services businesses around the globe. Previously, he headed up legal support for Sun Microsystems joint ventures in emerging markets, and before that he was a partner at Holland & Hart, in fact founded the Boulder office of Holland & Hart, and most importantly an esteemed graduate of CU Law. Carrie Schiff, to Bill's left, is Chief Legal and Risk Officer for MWH Global. It's a global wet infrastructure sector leader, which I don't know if we'll get to explore what that means, but I would be interested. And prior to being at MWH, she was the Senior Vice President and General Counsel of Flextronics, and before that was with USANet, an email outsourcing firm. And going back one more, she was with Cooley as well. To her left is Heather Terenzio, who's the founder and CEO of Tectonic Group. They are oriented around software development, and her career includes executive positions at venture-backed startup companies as well as Fortune 1000 companies. She managed onshore and offshore operations. And maybe you could just say a quick word about your business model at Tectonic to baseline everybody for the discussion.
Sure. We're an offshore software development company, but we have a hybrid model where we do all of the management, project management here in the States, and all of our development gets done offshore. So it's approximately 20% onshore, 80% offshore. And we're in Armenia in Eastern Europe is where our team is. And we've had offices in Istanbul before, and we've done work in China, Singapore, Taiwan, and Mexico, international level.
So Ram detailed best practices, risks, potential upside. Talk about that specific to the software world. So I am an emerging company, maybe a startup or a little bit larger company, and I come to you. When does this seem to work well to look to a company like Tectonic for software outsourcing?
Yeah, well, I thought it was actually really funny because I have almost the identical set of slides. Like, I've given that presentation thousands of times before because they are all exactly the same kinds of issues. They're IP, they're security, they're quality. trust, and we kind of go through the same issues with all our clients. But my argument is usually you should go through those exact same slides if you're working with a firm in Eastern Boulder, you know, as opposed to Eastern Europe or India. Those are the exact same questions you should be asking everyone. And anytime someone comes to me and talks about the IP issues, I say, well, you know, a 23-year-old in Boulder probably has more idea what to go do with that IP than an Armenian knows what to do with your 401k system that you're developing. So it's, you know, they're really the same kinds of issues wherever you are in the world, and I consider myself a global citizen as well. I've lived in Europe as a kid, and you know, I travel all over the world for work all the time, and you know, people are just people wherever they are, and they're the same kinds of issues. There's good people, bad people, good skill sets, poor skill sets, and you really just have to find somebody you like working with and you trust. And it's funny because you can go through these lists of things and checklists of all these companies, and so much of the time it comes to that sit down face to face and going with someone you trust and you like and has been referred by somebody in your network. And again, it's that could be a global issue, that could be something here locally in Boulder. So it's all kind of the same wherever you are.
Let me pull in Bill here. So this is an interesting dynamic where I'm hoping there won't be a rift and a client blow up between Bill and Ram over the next 45. Well, it might be kind of fun, though. I mean, it'd be something to remember for the rest of the weekend. You should have seen these guys go at it. So Bill's a customer through VMware, and as a matter of business strategy, this goes to some of what Ram teed up in terms of motivations for what you rely upon a provider outside the company to do. Maybe you talk about how you guys establish this relationship and how this fits into the overall business strategy for VMware.
So I think that Ram hit the nail right on the head when he said you have to understand why you're outsourcing in order for it to work. And you know, this is something that I've done twice now, first at Sun and then at VMware, where we went and we looked at really where are our core competencies. And we're looking to scale and get as much value as we can out of every aspect of our input. So we start out and we say we want to automate as much as we can. We then go and look at what are the things that really aren't our core competency that we're being very expensive by doing either in-house or onshore or both. You know, there's a lot of stuff I could send to a law firm, but it wouldn't make any sense. They'd be more expensive than I am in-house, and I'm both neither as good or as cheap as doing it through an outsourcer like Ram. So we went and we identified, you know, kind of those areas that we thought were the sweet spot where we would get a better product and become more scalable and free up resources that we could then go to deploy to something that was more their core competency and better effectiveness. So that's kind of the process that we went through in deciding whether to outsource.
Let me ask a question related to the best practices checklist that you detailed. Did you go through these steps in terms of clear end objectives, metrics, objectives, milestones, an internal project manager, diligence, visits? Talk a little bit about how the relationship emerged between you and Ram.
Well, I think emergence is a good way to describe it. I mean, we went into this thinking that we were hitting every tick on the box in terms of going and checking it, and we learned a lot as we went, as we went along. We interviewed a lot of different firms. We did an RFP. We went and visited sites. Frankly, I think it would be negligent to go and outsource something without physically visiting the site, seeing where your work's being done, knowing the people, and going regularly. But we still missed a lot of things at the start. And, you know, I'll remember the time that the first project that I worked with Ram on and his team on M&A due diligence. It was a natural fit for us, and the first project didn't go that well. And we stopped and we stepped back and said, why didn't it go well? And most of the issue when we really looked at it was on our end, in the sense that we hadn't given enough thought as to getting the process set up right so that it would work, and we hadn't put in enough effort on our end in managing it. And you know, one of the things you have to do in your budget is just add a cost item for managing the relationship. You know, just like you wouldn't take a really sophisticated project and give it to a junior employee with no supervision, you can't just go throw it over the wall. You have to have your time there. So we spent a bunch of time worked very closely with Ram's team and came up with a better process. The second one went a lot smoother. The third one was even better. And you know, now we have a really good scalable process that works well. I think in just about anything you do, you're going to have to assume that the first project isn't going to get you optimal efficiency. You'll have some issues there, and you'll have to be prepared to go and work on it.
Ram, from your perspective, talk about, it was interesting, Bill said, in reflection, a lot of that had to do with the information that you guys weren't providing. From the service provider perspective, what do you do to try to get ahead of that problem, and what is just, you can't do that the first time and you're going to learn?
See, I think a lot of, if you look at what is needed, right, in terms of making any outsourcing or offshoring work, you have a list of general objectives and specific objectives. So general objectives would be things like security, confidentiality, your general quality process, your recruitment process, like what is the retention, what is the attrition, things of that nature. So usually those things most good vendors would be very transparent with, and we were with Bill and with the other clients as well. So usually those are sort of the base fundamentals. But then if you, in order to make a relationship successful, you need to go beyond that and look at the specifics of how do you need to customize the existing, you know, their methodologies, your training, for example, your deliverable, your more, for example, M&A in the tech industry is very different from M&A in the manufacturing industry. And even within the tech industry, M&A from VMware would be very different from M&A from a different company in terms of what you look at. So those are the specifics that you need to sort of customize and modify. And while you can have training, as we both did initially, you cannot finalize, or in order to refine the process, you do need to go through a couple of iterations, almost like pilots in terms of going through. I think that's where the process gets fine-tuned even further. And we are constantly revising it. I mean, our support for Bill's group and other lawyers within his company has grown significantly. So each time it grows, you know, you recalibrate, you look at it, and then you make modifications to make sure that you're delivering consistently what the expectation is.
Carrie, let me turn to you, and before I ask you a subsequent question, let's get this out of the way. Wet infrastructure sector leader? What's that mean?
I didn't make that up. MWH Global is an engineering and construction company, and what we do is it's a service provider, in a sense, an outsourced service provider, in a sense. We design and we manage the construction of water-related projects. So everything from, we have a project down in Panama, we're designing the new third lock, which is a really enormous lock to go through the Panama Canal, which is currently the current, there's two parallel set of locks that are too narrow to allow the size carrier container ships that we need or that globally are transported to fit. So MWH does that design work. We design hydropower plants. We do asset management, which in my world now means managing wastewater treatment plants for municipalities is one example of what we might do. So it's providing these services, and it's a global company doing work all over the world, places I don't want to go. I've gone a lot of places. I've gone a lot of places, but there are some places that are not on my bucket list. So.
Well, now you know you've got to eat the food as well.
I love to eat the food. I've eaten lots of lunches in cafeterias in China. So.
All right, so I want to ask you, so before this role, I know that you were at Flextronics, which was extremely lean from the legal perspective.
As is my current company.
So you're comfortable, or maybe comfort's not the right word, you are accustomed to working, you know, with duct tape and chewing gum to make
it
happen.
That's right.
But
most
nonetheless,
people are. I'm sure Bill is too.
With large companies, and so I'd like to elaborate on something that Ram started with in terms of important contracting issues associated with international business. I'd like to tee you up for that. But then I'd also like to bring some of this after Carrie's response to the startup level. And the problem that I'm seeing is this, that there's unprecedented opportunities for startups to participate in international ways and to lever international tools. But when you look at these best practices and repeat activity, you're at a serious disadvantage as a startup. So let's talk about, first of all, the Mercedes treatment in terms of if we're going to contract this the right way, what does it look like, and what are some important issues? And then let's bring it down to the startup level and what's going to be good enough.
Okay, so I never have driven a Mercedes, but I actually, in truth be told, I come from outsourcing businesses. I come from that. That's my Flextronics is an outsourced manufacturing company, and prior to that, I was with an email outsourcing company. I believe in outsourcing, and I have looked at outsourcing, the legal, since at least as early as 2003. I was trying to think of the first time I got an email from my CEO at Flextronics saying, when are you going to outsource the legal department? Like, and I went, what? And he forwarded me an email from an article where GE, which at the time was advertising through press, its shared services center in India, that they were trying to sell these services that they were using for themselves on a captive basis. They were trying to bring customers in. And my way of doing due diligence, which is critical and the first thing you have to do, is I look at who's quoted in the article and I get their phone number and I call them up. And I say, okay, so tell me, what is it that you're talking about really? And in that case, what they were really talking about was spinning off that business and selling it, and they were no longer going to use it for themselves because it was no longer captive, which was a really important for me as I started to think about this, because for the legal function, the companies that I have been responsible for, I did not have the kind of work that I was comfortable could really truly be outsourced to a third party. And so I typically call it high volume, low touch. So high volume means I have to have enough work that it makes sense to make this investment. And it is an investment. You heard it from the last panel. This is, I think of this not as, it's all these fancy words, outsourcing, offshoring, shared services centers, all those things. And all it really means is you're going to get somebody somewhere else to do something for you, do something versus sell you something versus buying a widget. We're everyone's very comfortable in the world with, I'm going to buy a chip from Korea, or I'm going to buy an Xbox from Mexico. I mean, nobody thinks twice about buying that thing that you can touch and feel and get comfortable with, whether it hits your quality requirements. It's when somebody's doing a service for you that everyone thinks we have to have a panel. How do you do it? It's like hiring somebody. It's exactly what you keep hearing. It's relationship building. It requires high touch. It requires that you are there, that as your business changes and evolves, your contracts are going to change and evolve. Your needs are dynamic, and the people who are working for you need to be able to respond to those needs. And when it comes to the legal issues, be proactive about it. And what I found was there is hard enough to manage my global legal team, where they at least I knew I could fire them and just replace them. I didn't have to worry about where their hard drive was. But to think about how I integrate a third-party provider was the same challenge for me, as how might I integrate a law firm, a local law firm down the street. And I did not have that kind of work. We were, all of my companies have been companies that have been, for whatever reason, unable to force our customers to do business on our paper, to force our suppliers to do business on our paper. I mean, if I could get that, I mean, hell, I could cut my legal department in half again. But if I can't even get there, then how do I integrate people who, ever you hear them say they work overnight? Well, my sales guys don't work after 5, so they're not going to take a call at 10 or 11 or 12 to talk to a guy about what they need to do to modify the agreement and to have the conference call where you're in your 6-hour marathon negotiation. That doesn't work. You have to have the kind of low touch business or work that can be done on an off-hours basis, where you can work together to outline what the expectations are and manage through something that's not hugely time-sensitive, where you have a limited group of people who are trained to have to interact and communicate with each other, as opposed to your whole sales force or your controllers. Or it's the sort of, who's going to be working with that person? Because it's just like
hiring a person. So I never found that I had that, but what I did find and what I did before my last company, and I'm currently, I've got, you know, my emails from the CEO saying, when are you going to outsource the legal department? It's all over again, new article being forwarded to me. I look for the things that I need to do that are really the infrastructure for my part of the company, my part of the business. Whether it's database management or analytics, it's the what do I not have either? The people, lawyers are not good at analyzing budgets and helping me with my forecasting. That's great use of, for me, outsource support. They're not good at the, I'll call it contract administration as opposed to contract management, which is more of a kind of the professional negotiators. It's the administration. You need to know where your paper is. You need to know how you're going to get it when you need it. And that's, again, a great opportunity. I have been fortunate. I had a shared services center at my last company. We have a shared, it was in Chennai. It's not just the lawyers that get these emails from the CEO. Finance gets them, HR gets them, IT gets them. Everybody that's overhead, not revenue generating, gets these letters or these emails. And so I was able to nest in my last shared services center what I called the legal vertical, which were a number of different functions that supported my governance, my contract administration, compliance, and then some of the securities M&A work, the back office stuff, and then my budget and forecasting analytics. And then in my new position, MWH, we have a design center in Pune, and we're building up our shared services center around that, because we have found that it's like any employee, you have to think about career path. You have to think about, attrition can be an issue when you have an employee, your employees that are in your building. It's an issue if they're the law firm that you love to work with, those associates that you adore, they can get jobs other places. Attrition is always an issue. So for us, we focus on what are looking at the variety of activities that we can put into that shared services center. And if I did have the maturity in my organization where I felt like I had enough volume to outsource, I'd still be thinking about not just volume, but variety of work, so I can keep a team of people involved in my business and getting to know what we do, and really retain, using that as a part of my retention tool. From a contractual perspective, my view is the contract is just the paper. I can have a wonderful contract that makes sure on paper that I have provisions that say you will comply with the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act. You will. So what if they don't? I've got a problem, and that paper is not going to help me. I can have a contract that says you will hit these service levels, and I'm sorry if I offend anybody, but good luck suing anyone in India. My grandchildren might see the end of that lawsuit. And the same thing goes in many other jurisdictions. And let's say you do win wherever you are. And my last employer, we had shared services center in Shenzhen for China because of language issues. That was really where we centralized support for China. Wasn't Romania. Where was Eastern Europe? I can't remember where it was in Eastern Europe. I think it was Romania for Europe. And then we had Chennai. But we had this distribution. But if I had a problem and I needed to actually go collect damages for wherever I was going, good luck collecting. I win, great. Now what? Go get your money. Good luck. So it's not that, to me, it's the relationship. It's thinking about what you're going to send over there. And making sure that you, I think Bill made the point before about controls, that you're actually operationally prepared, whether it's figuring out how you back up your data on the server that's in India without letting them have that server with access to the internet so people can get in and steal your stuff, but if you want the security and lock it down in that design center or in that R&D center locked on that server, no one has access except those developers, well, good luck going and getting your stuff if you have a problem with that supplier. So you got to just manage through that.
Well, let me tee up Ram to respond to a couple of those elements.
But I believe in outsourcing.
crowdsourcing. I believe in it.
For manufacturing.
Several points that are raised, several of them valid, but at the same time, let me respond to them.
You think some of them are invalid?
I think several are valid.
Several are invalid.
So, obviously, if it is not structured correctly, you will have several of the issues that you raise. But so let's go through several of them. So the first one is in terms of live support, time zone, turnaround times, etc. I can tell you that we support 13 time zones right now for several of our global clients. So we have teams of our lawyers where, depending on the team, we sort of map it out in terms of time so that there are dedicated phone lines for our UK clients. We have UK numbers for our US clients. We have US numbers for California clients. We have a California number they can find it. So it really depends. But to do that, you need to set it up right, right? So if it is done correctly, it is possible to bridge the gap. And I agree that there is a time zone difference. There is a sort of a difference with respect to bridging that, but it is possible to do that. The second and third points that I wanted to respond, I think importantly, are the legal issue in terms of collecting in India or any other jurisdiction. I can't comment on China. I have not done business in China, so I don't know. But if an outsourcing contract is structured correctly, it will have a provision of application of U.S. law and jurisdiction of application of U.S. courts. And generally, most reputed providers have their parents in the U.S. or an established, you know, a large subsidiary in the U.S. that you can go after legally. So your contracting entity should be a U.S. entity in addition to an Indian entity if you want to do that. And secondly, even if there is, say, let's say you go through the litigation and then you get a judgment in the U.S., it is possible to get it enforced in India because there is reciprocity between the two jurisdictions, just as it's possible to get a judgment in India and get the U.S. courts to enforce it. And finally, with respect to theft of data, server protection, etc., I can tell you that, I mean, what we do is a small company. There are established companies, the larger outsourcing shops that deal with billions and billions of dollars of worth of business for clients all over. And the protection that you have in the development centers anywhere in Bangalore and Hyderabad are probably the same, if not far more, than what you would find in any comparable center anywhere in the world. You cannot get into those facilities unless you're on an authorized list, unless you go through a series of checks and balances. And even in our company, the restriction is such that, for example, if you get in, you don't have access to download material, you don't have access to email material other than through restricted servers, etc. So there is a lot of protection that is put in place to safeguard information. Now, that's not specific to, say, the legal space. I think that's in general. Probably about 15 or 20 years ago, I think what you raised are valid points in terms of security issues, etc. But I think there's a bigger risk of data being stolen anywhere in the world as opposed to, say, one of these protected development centers, because the levels, the checks and balances are so many that it would trip up if assuming something were to happen, and there are remedial measures that are put in place. So, I mean, this happens pretty much all through in terms of the prediction. So those were the three points that I want to respond to.
I want to raise similar questions to Heather, because you're in a really unique situation where you are between, say, emerging company in the United States and an outsourced team in currently Armenia. Uh-huh. And before that, I know you worked with other teams. And so I assume if something goes wrong, you're ultimately on the hook with the U.S. client. First of all, is that correct? Yeah. Do I have it right?
Yeah, that's actually, I think, what sets us apart from some of our competitors is that we're an American company. If anything happens with your code, you come after us.
And when things have gone wrong with the team, I'm sure it never happened, but hypothetically, if something went wrong somewhere else, some of these issues that Carrie and Ram are going back and forth about in terms of jurisdiction, where is the dispute going to be resolved, and ability to collect. What has your experience been like in the software space?
Well, we set up contracts with our team in Armenia. And actually, what we've done is, from a tax perspective, is that we formed Tectonic Group Armenia. We have Tectonic Group USA. We used to have Tectonic Group Turkey as well. But we have contracts set up with them that all these provisions are in there. But I agree with Carrie in that if we actually had to go after them and sue them in Armenian courts, and it's, you know, we kind of have an understanding that that's just not going to work ever. And that's actually the assurance that we give to our clients is more, you come after us. It's not like you're trying to sue an offshore entity. So it's a difficult situation, and you can put all that stuff on paper and in place, but I mean, a lot of our clients are startups, and, you know, and even us ourselves, I don't think we could afford the legal team that it would take to actually go after, you know, a company in a different country.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think anybody really relies on the contract. You want to have it, but what it really comes down to is, have you done your due diligence? And when we're out sourcing something that's really sensitive, what's critical to me is that the person I'm doing business with has more to lose if this thing blows up than I do. I mean, I look at Rob. His bread and butter is the Am Law 20 and the biggest corporations around the world. If we've got a real problem and you know, there's a blow up, he's going to work with me. Yeah, I mean, he does not want to see a problem out there. We have a shared interest to go and make sure that the security is good, the work is done well, and it's done right. And I'm confident that we're going to be able to work things out. And we put an awful lot of effort into finding that. I mean, Carrie, you were spot on when you said it's just like hiring an employee. And you've got the same issues when you're bringing employees on domestically or abroad. You've got to go through that same diligence.
Do you have any additional thoughts on that?
I think that's a valid point in terms of, again, goes to alignment of incentives, because in some respects you want to make sure that it's set up in such a way. But still, I would still recommend having a, much as contracts don't matter, having a ironclad contract in place. And I agree with what Heather was saying as well, that in general, at least our experience has been that our U.S. parent is the one that enters into the contracts. And, you know, while it is possible for clients in theory to go after our Indian subsidiary, the far reach of the U.S. jurisdiction is such that if you're set up in the U.S., then it doesn't matter where your operations are, you'll still be liable. I mean, and so I think in some respects you need to have that protection. But in addition to that, you need to make sure that the incentives are aligned, that there's no reason for the vendor to sort of... in a service industry, it's very difficult for it to actually get into that stage. I think I agree with that. Usually you will resolve... far before it gets into that stage of litigation.
One more general question that I want to see if we can take some of the best practices and boil them down to, could a startup do this? And if so, how? What are the shortcuts that are out there? But the general question relates to, I think, some of Carrie's skepticism, and I suspect that Heather might have had some of this experience as well. Lots of concerns in terms of IP protection, privacy and security. You know, one approach in terms of privacy and security is to have that in the technology, which I hear you saying. Mm-hmm. Another approach is in the contracting. Maybe Carrie,
actually,
you can
talk about. You have to be careful with privacy. So when I think of privacy, I think of employee data privacy, which for a lot of the outsourcing that companies will do is they'll do things like payroll or things that are HR related, even processing. I know Microsoft, one of the things I had a phone call about was they, and Microsoft, like 20% of their budget, it was, a lot of it was their visas, for part of their global mobility program, they sent that work all to their semi-captive outsourcing group. And whenever you send employee data, you have to worry about the privacy laws around the world, especially in Europe. And those are not a put it in the contract. That is, can be maybe needing to get consent from employees in order to send their data out of their country. So you have to think through things that are more operational as opposed to just, can you put it in the contract? Mm-hmm. So, and then the other is consumer privacy, which, you know, is the nightmare of the day, which is somebody steals somebody's customer information, and that was really more operational protections as opposed to in the contract. Once that's out, that's brand issue. That's a lot of issues.
So. Bill, do you have a comment on that?
No, I was just going to shift over to your comment about startups and.
Can we table that for just a second? So I want to Heather, in terms of IP and working with offshore teams, what's your experience been?
I mean, you have to work with a reputable company. You have to work with someone who's been around. You know, I'm sure Rom couldn't be in business as long as he is. I couldn't have been in business as long as I have if IP getting stolen is an issue for you. So that's kind of part of your due diligence is, you know, have they been around for a while and do they have a track record of not stealing IP? And again, just, you know, people are people and you can't guarantee anywhere in the world that that's not going to happen. But, you know, you look for people who have low turnover rates and people who've been around for a long time and high loyalty and that you can trust. And again, it's a company that you can trust. It's a relationship that you're building. And, you know, again, you can put all that legal stuff in place, but that's, you know, that doesn't always work in the States and it doesn't always work offshore.
So, Bill, I know you've got a comment on that, and then I also do want to transition back to where you started in terms of specific to a startup perspective. What about this could be takeaways?
Yeah, so I'll do a segue between the do contracts matter and startups and entrepreneurs, because I think they really do. And this comes back to a comment that Eva had, a discussion in her presentation around bribery. And when you talk about outsourcing, most of what we're talking about right here is inbound activities, cost items that we are outsourcing out. But really, one of the main things that gets outsourced that all of these other panels talked about under a different guise is sales. Whenever you hire a distributor, a reseller, a commercial agent, anyone like that, you are outsourcing your sales. And one of the things that you do have an obligation as a U.S. company to do is to make sure that anybody in your supply chain is complying with applicable laws, including the FCPA, and if you're subject to UK laws, you've got the new UK anti-bribery, OECD, and all of that. And there's a couple ways that this will really come back and bite you as an entrepreneur, as a startup company, if you're not paying attention right from the start. And that is, think of your exit strategy. If you're thinking about going public and you're going to go and file an S1, you're going to have to disclose if you do not have adequate gifts and hospitality policies, if you don't have practices for compliance in place. If you're looking to get acquired by a U.S. company, forget it if you don't have it clean. I mean, you will be diligenced on that. If you have violations, you're going to have real issues. Your deal is not going to go through until they're cleaned up. Even if you have weak controls, that's something that people are going to be all over, and your exit is going to get slowed down. Same thing if you're looking to get funded by private equity. So you have to take care of stuff up front, and that's where the contract will help. It's not alone enough, but people are going to want to see that. So if you don't have your house in order in that area and have a good contract in place, and this particular outsourced vendor or distributor is accounting for a huge part of your business, you're going to have problems with your investors.
That's a great point. Carrie, other thoughts if you're a startup looking at outsourcing in general or perhaps working with a company on software?
So I think you can't just look at the labor rates and get excited about the cost savings, because of all the reasons you've heard from all the different panels about how much more, you know, how much cost is on top of managing that. And I do think you should consider strategies, and I've used this, where I've looked at, I've costed out bringing in Pangea or other of the outsource groups in India, and then I've gone to my U.S. firms and I've said, okay, like this piece of litigation, this document production, this is what I could get from Pangea, you better match it. You match it or I'm going to them and you have to work with them, and they match it. So I think that there's strategy for using it to drive pricing down. That is, frankly, can help to, because there's always the argument that there's a little bit of cost savings and not having to manage someone so far, and that's not really under your nose right there when you're trying to get the work done. So don't hesitate to think of it as a benchmark to use to drive your other provider's costs down.
Yeah, we try and scare away the early stage startups, because usually they don't realize how much it's going to cost, even if they are using an offshore model. And then you have one person who's doing 10 different roles. And if you don't have somebody focused on your development role, you know, it's a recipe for disaster. So, you know, we try and scare them and like, you know, do you know what you're getting into? And, you know, they're going to have the exact same issues with an onshore company, but, you know, they're kind of in the stage where we just want a friend who will do it for equity. You know, that's not a good stage to be in. We're more, you know, get some funding, get, you know, earlier stage, and have a good, clear vision in place, and then we can start executing on that. Because if it's too early in the game, then you might as well go to Rent-A-Coder or one of those kinds of things and try and get it done. But to go to a company or kind of a more organized institution, I think they're going to have some problems.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're right. As an early stage company, outsourcing to me is something that's almost 100% binary. And what I mean by that is you're either doing something 100% in-house because it's your core competency, and your core competencies may shift over time, or you should outsource the whole thing with a complete SaaS-type solution where you're not in this hybrid situation, which is what we've been talking about, of, well, some of the design is coming from your internal engineers, and it's being executed on by an outsourced software firm, or we're going to manage a certain part of the legal things and use Ram's shop to go and provide the back end. I mean, I think as a small company, you're more all or nothing than you are as a big company. And you can go and look to refine as you go along. But, I mean, if I were starting a company right now, I wouldn't get into HR. I wouldn't run my own IT. I mean, just go outsource the whole thing. Accept what's off the shelf. That's what your solution's going to be. Just build around it. If you need to customize down the road, hopefully you're big enough that you can afford it.
Ram, one final question. Sure. As it relates to legal practitioners in firms in the area. There's an interesting analog. So as I'm sure you're aware, the transactional business model is under a great deal of stress. Specific to this area, several large national firms that were catering to emerging companies have either abandoned altogether or restructured their business model. And what's resulted has been many medium-sized firms and small firms with some very high-quality and experienced attorneys who have their own shingle out there. For those startup-type situations in the legal world, does it make sense to look at a firm like yours, or is that just something that is a bad idea?
I think it absolutely makes sense. The reason is leverage, because if you have a smaller law firm, and we have several, while, as Bill said, the majority of our clients tend to be in the Am Law 20 and the larger law firms, but we do work with several highly specialized litigation boutiques and say they're specializing in certain industry where they may be small firms, but they're experts in their area, and by using us, they're able to leverage in terms of what they can do. For example, if there's a large document review that needs to be done, we will be able to support the process and in terms of the resources and the technology to support that otherwise may be difficult for them to provide. So, but at the same time, I think in some respects, it is you do need to see what is the sort of services and the support that the firm or the lawyer is looking for. Because if it is something that's highly specialized, say drafting an M&A agreement, that is not something that's going to be amenable to this model. But as part of the M&A transaction, if it's, say, during the base diligence of reviewing 100 or 1,000 contracts and looking at the abstracts with the lawyer in terms of going through in detail, or performing a document review of several hundred thousand documents and then looking at the key documents, then that is something that leverage is certainly possible. So you do need to see what activities within the transactional support that the law firms are providing will work in this model.
Let's open up to audience questions. And if there's a student with a question, we'll go student prerogative first. Unfortunately, Kent and I just made eye contact, and I see Ben in the back, so I'll give Kent and Ben, and there's Katie behind, an opportunity to stare each other down. Ben, you're closest to the microphone.
I guess I'll just keep it maybe school-specific then. Since I'm on the cusp of going out there and looking for a job now, how do you see this new model impacting students? Because time was, we got the jobs that are being outsourced. So where is that pipeline going now?
It's
can I help him out on that one?
Ben, are you amenable to a friendly addition?
Okay, so I get calls from law students who are finishing, and non-traditional law students. So they're a little bit older, and some have children, and they have $130,000 to $150,000 loans. And they're looking for, entering the workforce, looking for, and they're U.S. They're great folk. So where does that fit in terms of outsourcing legal, and especially at a university, outsourcing legal, or the grad students and the incredibly talented kids coming out of CU Boulder?
So two sides to this. on the one hand, there's specific strategies for someone like Ben. By the way, hire Ben if you're looking for a legal writer. He's coming out as a third year. So that's one side in terms of strategies of someone trying to negotiate this new world of legal services. And then second, to your point, is that to the extent that there's a glut of attorneys willing to do transactional work, does that take a chunk out of your business model in that the price of legal services may be going down?
Yeah, actually, to answer both, the markets do change. In fact, as along with development of technology, development processes, you know, you find certain more efficient ways of doing more basic things, which previously perhaps used to be done by more senior level folks, but now can be done by more junior or by technology for that matter. So that being said, I think the market in the U.S. has changed such that, for example, at least in our company, we are opening a review center in the U.S. Actually, we're within the next month or so, we should be doing that. So there is a lot of talent that's available, which is complementing. So in other words, one of the reasons we're doing that is to provide a combination of, you know, onshore, offshore, depending on what the need is, specific skill sets that may be available in a particular jurisdiction that may not be available elsewhere, et cetera. So you have to look at the market, and it is possible to respond so that you take into account all of that. To answer your specific question, I think in some respects, if you were going into law school and at least the primary, let's assume the career was to go through doing basic document review, et cetera, then that is in some respects beyond a certain point that is not very attractive. But that being said, with the change in technology and the change in training and how law firms now are, I would say, almost restructuring the practice to make sure that the classes that they hire are perhaps a little bit smaller and easier to be absorbed directly into the legal advice that they provide to clients, et cetera, I think it'll change. As we're going through the transition, it obviously is difficult in terms of going through, but I think several law firms are in the process of restructuring, wherein junior associates that come on are working directly on client projects in terms of whether it's research or other areas as well.
Any thoughts on that? Heather, let me ask you, so with respect to scarcity, especially in the Boulder area, software engineers, so for those of you who are at the last New Tech Meetup, there were at least 60 positions that were offered at the outset by several companies, which makes me think that finding local talent around software is a real challenge. Are you seeing that?
Yeah, I mean, we get hired a lot just because they can't find people to do the work. And so they actually don't even care that we're onshore or offshore or where we are. They just need bodies to actually get this work done. That being said, I think there's a space for both models. I think there's a space for onshore work, and I think there's a space for offshore work. We tend to do the work that Americans don't like to do for the most part. You know, it's kind of the lower end, it's the maintenance stuff, it's more repetitive kind of work. But at the same time, we need the really experienced software developers to manage those teams. So we actually hire really experienced software developers to manage our teams of folks offshore. So I think there's room for everybody in it. And with our business, it's kind of countercyclical to when the economy, because in down economies, people are looking for lower prices, but in up economies, there's just nobody to find to actually get the work done, and that's where we come in. So.
Other questions? Vic, and then we'll come up here.
Thanks, Dave. So this is a little bit of a big picture question. In addition to tax, I teach a deals course. And outsourcing is a really interesting sort of question of contract and governance design. And this goes all the way back to Ronald Coase and his paper on the nature of the firm. You always have a choice between making or buying. So if you think about the boundaries of the firm, Coase's theory is that it's determined by transaction costs. And so where transaction costs are low in the market, you go out and buy what you need, whether it's something in your supply chain or services that you need. If you know what you're buying and the market works well and it's efficient, you just go out and buy it from the marketplace. Where those transaction costs are high, you bring it in-house. And so if you have strategy, you can't really outsource that very easily. You keep that within the firm. And the expansion of outsourcing in recent years is really interesting because it's kind of a hybrid. So you can imagine at one extreme, you're buying something that's completely commodified and there's no governance problems at all. So it's like, you know, buying clothes or something. If you if you get it wrong, you just go buy from somebody else the next time. And at the other extreme, you can imagine opening a subsidiary in India, which is going to just be a part of your firm. And, of course, the management there, those costs can be really high. And so my question is, when you think about outsourcing, not just in the legal context, but more broadly, what are the contract mechanisms that you use that seem to work to reduce the transaction costs that you have with your foreign partner? So we're not dealing with things that are purely commodities. So you have to have some kind of an agreement in the contract about how you're going to assess the quality of what's being produced, how you're going to make sure that the managers are doing a good job and are that their incentives are properly aligned. So how do you approach that contract design problem?
Great question, Bill.
So I don't think it's so much a contract design problem as a question of how much have you commoditized what you're doing. And I'll give you a perfect example. If you are going to go and run your own CRM system in-house to go and manage your sales activity, and you want to go and outsource that to an IT outsourcing shop, they can do it for you. They can probably save you some money on it. But your transaction cost of moving into that and moving out is incredibly high. I mean, just moving your IT infrastructure, it is phenomenally high. If instead of taking that route, you say, we will commoditize, and we're going to go to Salesforce.com and take 100% commoditized, off-the-shelf SaaS service that's available, now all of a sudden your transaction costs have gotten much, much lower in terms of moving around. You still have problems of getting your data out. Is there a credible alternative you can go to? But it is so much easier to do that once you've commoditized than it is if you're running something in a non-commoditized fashion. So if you want to get the transaction costs down, I don't think it's so much a contracting issue as what's the underlying thing you're doing and does it make sense for your business to go and commoditize?
It's the scope of work, not the contract. And it's the when you talk about commoditized, it's you've got to be configuring, not customizing. And it's much easier when you are just beginning, though not too early, because you haven't set up all of these disparate systems that are not necessarily necessary to have talk to each other. It's hard. It's really, really hard when you already have your spaghetti mix of you know 50 different tools that already are customized, not configured. And to think about how we might move a piece out, you start having to think about moving the whole out, and that's overwhelming. So I think it's not the contract doesn't.
Yeah. You don't view yourself as in a governance relationship with your outsourcing partner.
It is, but it's the
tail. It's not the dog. On it. Yeah, there's things that we can go and we can put in the contract that will, you know, give you outs, make it a little easier to move. You know, you can require in an IT outsourcing contract that they'll assist you and hold back money to make sure that they actually perform and such. But that's small potatoes compared to addressing the underlying issues.
The first thing you've heard, I think, from everybody, not just this panel, others, is you have to have a clear vision about what you want. You have to, and clarity in this, it's really hard. I loved Katrin's picture when she showed the mark, the strategy, and it was like the nice boxes, and then she went to the other one, which was the whiteboard.
That's not the picture that everyone thought you were going to go to.
I like that one too. But it is like the I don't care how mature the company is, how big they are. You open you open it up and you look inside, and it is a mess of systems. And it's being able to say, okay, if I want to think of a game analogy, and I can't. But if you pull that one piece out, it's probably like Jenga. Pull that out. What's going to happen? Is the tower going to fall? And that's about clarity in what you're looking for, clarity in what you need, and how what impact it's going to have if you move a piece out. And do you need to move more? Do you need to take the whole top? And that's not the contract scope.
Final question up there.
This is just a simple question. Is your company doing this legal outsourcing for law firms in other jurisdictions besides the United States, either English-speaking or other countries?
Yeah, we do work with UK, several firms in the UK as well. Thank you.
Well, let me say a few things in closing before we thank the panel. One is, now I tell you that this conference today was a little bit of an experiment. Actually, Bill has been nudging us for some time to do more in the international arena. And I've got to say, between these three panels and the speakers, it's been really incredibly informative from my perspective. So I want to thank everybody who's been involved. There's certainly plenty that's left on the table in this area. And part of the objective of this was to catalyze some ongoing discussions around how do startup opportunities in this area for new companies as well as emerging companies intersect with the international nature of where we are today. One that I think is really interesting that Vic and Eva teed up is in terms of regional advantage as to why people like and want to start business in the Front Range. How is this going to look going forward in terms of relationships across borders? Another that we started to get into on this panel was just speaking to Lee Reichert, who does a lot of international legal work. And there's a lot of legal issues that we could certainly get into mining. And so going forward, I would welcome your input in terms of, as we take this conversation forward, what does that look like? Additionally, I want to say a special thank you to J.P. Morgan, who's going to be sponsoring the reception and beverages that we'll enjoy momentarily. Many thank yous to the panel, and thank you for being here. This was terrific.
Thanks, Ben.